surprising origins and their far-reaching impact.
These are drugs that are influencing far more than you might imagine in your life.
The Hunger Game on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, next Monday to Friday lunchtime at 1:45.
On FM, on BBC Sounds, and on your smart speaker. This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Tuesday the 3rd of February. This is Today with Justin Webb and Anna Foster.
The headlines this morning: police are reviewing allegations that Lord Mandelson passed sensitive government information to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And ministers are outlining the UK's first ever strategy to tackle environmental contamination from so-called forever chemicals.
Also in today's programme, a mum says too many red flags were missed before her 15-year-old son, Harvey Wilgoose, was stabbed to death at school. We'll hear her call for change 1 year on. As a major new exhibition opens, historian Tom Holland explores the enduring allure of the samurai and why Britain is so captivated by Japan. And as the Lords prepares to debate whether there should be a law to ban phones in school, students and teachers in Manchester tell us what they think.
That would help schools because we'd all be in the same boat. It would be fair, and then we'd more likely to get the buy-in from the parents and the families.
I would prefer to have my phone on me just in case that there might be an emergency, like at home.
The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
The government has said it'll provide whatever assistance is needed as the Metropolitan Police considers accusations that Lord Mandelson passed sensitive government information to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Scotland Yard said last night it was reviewing allegations of misconduct in public office. Documents released by the US authorities appear to show Epstein was sent details of internal discussions from the heart of the UK government. Our political correspondent Nick Eardley reports.
The latest files released by the US Department of Justice provide evidence of just how close the relationship between Lord Mandelson and Jeffrey Epstein was. When he was business secretary, Lord Mandelson appeared to share a message written by an aide to the then Prime Minister Gordon Brown discussing the possible sale of government assets. He also appeared to confirm plans for a €500 billion bailout by Eurozone countries. After calls for police to investigate, the Metropolitan Police said last night that it was reviewing reports of alleged misconduct to determine if they met the criminal threshold for investigation. Lord Mandelson has not responded to requests for comment about the allegations. The government said it would provide whatever support and assistance the police needed. Lord Mandelson also continues to face pressure to step down from the House of Lords, with the government saying he should no longer be a member of the chamber.
The former US President Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary have agreed to testify in the congressional investigation into Jeffrey Epstein. The couple had faced the possibility of being held in criminal contempt of Congress after refusing requests to appear before lawmakers. A spokesman said they looked forward to setting a precedent that applies to everyone. Last night, Sarah Ferguson's charity, Sarah's Trust, announced it was closing for the foreseeable future after new revelations emerged about the former Duchess of York's friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. Emails from the latest release of documents suggest she was in contact with Epstein while he was in prison and visited him at his Palm Beach mansion with her daughters Beatrice and Eugenie just days after he was released. Sarah Ferguson has been approached for comment. The government has drawn up its first ever national plan to tackle the harmful so-called forever chemicals found in the environment. They're known as PFAS and are used in many everyday products such as non-stick pans and waterproof fabrics, but accumulate in water, soil and animals, causing contamination. The plan includes increased nationwide testing, as Esme Stallard reports.
One of the most pressing chemical challenges of our time is how the Environment Minister Emma Hardy has characterised the struggle the government faces in dealing with PFAS. This plan aims to ramp up water testing for the chemicals by 50% across Scotland and Wales, and to survey animals and sample soils in coastal areas of England to identify hotspots. The plan does not include new regulations, but says that by December 2028, Great Britain will more closely align with the EU, which is looking to ban all non-essential uses of the chemicals, in a nod to pre-Brexit cooperation. The proposals have been welcomed by the Royal Society of Chemistry, but the water industry says it wants a complete ban to prevent the cost of cleaning up the UK's waters from mounting.
Elon Musk is merging his rocket company SpaceX with his artificial intelligence firm xAI, expanding the world's most valuable private company. The billionaire said the combined firm would work to install AI data centers in space, where they could harness power from the sun while avoiding the expense of cooling. More people are expected to pass through the Rafah crossing between the Gaza Strip and Egypt after its reopening yesterday. Only a few patients have managed to get out of Gaza to Egypt for medical treatment so far. Yolande Nell reports from Jerusalem.
The reopening of the Rafah crossing marked a key step in the Israel-Hamas ceasefire, but so far it's been mostly a symbolic one. No goods are allowed to pass through, and on the first day that people were permitted to cross, only a handful made it. Five patients left with companions and 12 people were allowed to return, falling far short of the 50 officials had said would be able to travel in each direction. About 20,000 Palestinians needing medical care are hoping to leave the devastated territory, while tens of thousands more are waiting to enter and return home. Palestinian officials blame delays on Israeli security checks, but there was no immediate comment from Israel's military.
The University of Sussex is beginning a High Court challenge to the record £585,000 fine imposed over its failure to uphold freedom of speech. The penalty followed the row around the resignation of Dr. Kathleen Stock, who left her job as Professor of Philosophy after student protests against her view that sex is more important than gender. The university will argue that the Office for Students overstepped its legal powers, while the regulator is expected to defend itself in a case with implications for every university in England. Here's our education editor, Branwen Jeffries.
The regulator had no legal power to investigate the individual case of Dr. Kathleen Stock. Instead, the Office for Students issued the fine on the basis of a trans and non-binary equality policy in place at the time. The regulator said it had a chilling effect on the freedom of speech. In court, the university will argue the two-page policy was not part of its governance. Sussex will also claim potential bias because of a pre-existing friendship between the regulator's Director for Freedom of Speech and Dr. Stock.
A debate is being held in the House of Lords on a potential ban on smartphones in schools. The government has recently strengthened its guidance to make clear that all schools should be phone-free environments for the whole day, but some teachers have called for that to be made law. And children and young people with cancer in England will have the cost of their travel for treatment paid for through a new government scheme. Ministers say the £10 million fund will support families who often face long and frequent journeys to specialist centres.
Thank you, Alan. It's 7 minutes past six. Let's see what the weather has in store today with Simon King. Morning, Simon.
Good morning, Anna. Well, the weather is going to be very similar to how it was yesterday, I'll be honest, for most of us. For Wales, southwest and southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England, it's really quite overcast this morning. And it's quite damp, actually, for some of us as well, with some light rain, some drizzle out there as well. The rain is likely to turn a little bit heavier and more widespread around southeast England up into the Midlands during this afternoon. And by this evening, we will start to get a little bit of snow over the higher ground of North Wales. Temperatures getting to about 3 to 7 degrees, but locally still up to about 11 degrees in southwest England. For northwest and northeast England, it's pretty overcast with some rain just over the Pennines this morning, but otherwise it's a mostly dry start for the day. And the day stays predominantly dry but cloudy with some hill fog, the possibility of some hill snow showers later in the Pennines and temperatures of 3 or 4 Celsius. Now for Northern Ireland, it's a cloudy day again with some light and patchy rain, likely more so during this afternoon, highs of 4 to 6 Celsius. And across Scotland, well, it's in northern and eastern Scotland where we've got some rain to low levels, but snow has been falling over the last 12 hours or so over the higher ground, and that's really going to continue today. Anything over 200 or 300 metres, we could see significant accumulations of 10 to 20 centimetres, strong southeasterly winds, blizzards are likely, temperatures about freezing or 1 Celsius, but for western Scotland, drier and brighter here with temperatures of 6 or 7 degrees.
Thank you for that. 9 minutes past six is the time. Let's have our first look at the papers. Most of the front pages focusing on the possibility of Lord Mandelson facing a police investigation after allegations that he shared sensitive government information with Jeffrey Epstein. Labour's dark lord now faces a criminal inquiry, is the Daily Mail's headline. Cops called, says The Sun.
The Guardian says the latest disclosures saw MPs line up in Parliament to express their fury. The Financial Times notes that Keir Starmer tried to, in the paper's words, limit the fallout by promising to find a way to remove Peter Mandelson from the House of Lords while announcing an official inquiry into the peer's conduct when he was a minister.
Lord Mandelson has not himself responded to requests for comment about the latest allegations, but The Times runs what it calls an exclusive interview with him about his links more generally to Jeffrey Epstein. He's quoted as saying he was too trusting of the disgraced financier and describes him as like muck you can't get off your shoe.
Many of the editorials argue that Lord Mandelson's political career is now over. The Daily Express says his reputation is in tatters. The Daily Mirror calls on him to do what is honourable and step down from the Lords. The Sun says he's previously enjoyed more comebacks than Elvis, Frank Sinatra and Tiger Woods put together. But the full extent of his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein is so shocking that he must now be finished once and for all.
In the Daily Telegraph reports on research which says cancer rates across Europe are rising among women under 50, but the trend isn't being seen among men. The findings come from the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development. It says cases of early onset cancer have risen by 16% among women aged below 50 since 2000, while the rate for men has stayed the same.
And some of the papers note that a fundraising drive to help protect the giant chalk figure in Dorset has reached its target in just 60 days. The Guardian says the National Trust has raised £330,000 with donations coming in from 20 different countries. The headline in the I newspaper is Giant Effort.
6:10 is the time. Bill and Hillary Clinton are going to testify to Congress after all over their links with Jeffrey Epstein, as I've been hearing from Peter Bowes.
The Clintons have for months been rebuffing requests from the committee, despite receiving summonses to appear in person to testify about what they know about Jeffrey Epstein. They had earlier provided written sworn statements to the House Oversight Committee, which they have argued contain all the relevant information that they have about Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. In an emailed declaration, Bill Clinton acknowledged that he flew on Epstein's private plane several times, explaining that the trips were in connection with the work of the Clinton Foundation. He has always denied any knowledge of Epstein's criminal conduct. Now, Hillary Clinton, in a sworn declaration, written declaration, she has said that she does not recall ever meeting Jeffrey Epstein. Now, they were getting close to being held in criminal contempt for their lack of cooperation. The Republican-led House of Representatives was due to vote later this week on the matter. That could potentially have had some serious consequences if the House voted in favour, if the Justice Department had then decided to prosecute, and if they were found guilty. They could have faced possible fines or even imprisonment, but now that won't happen.
Given that they say they don't know anything more, they haven't got any more information for the committee, you do wonder whether there is any progress at all being made anywhere towards actually prosecuting people who are involved in the abuse of children, because that, of course, was the underlying reason for the whole thing, wasn't it? And it doesn't seem to have happened.
Yeah, exactly. That is the key question. Many people, especially after the events of the last few days and all of these, this huge tranche of documents and videos that have been released that don't seem to move anyone any further forward in terms of perhaps identifying other individuals who might have been involved with Jeffrey Epstein, who may have committed crimes themselves. One interesting aspect of the Clintons potentially appearing, this of course is the same committee that would like to speak to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and potentially Peter Mandelson. Interestingly, the Clinton spokesperson said that they, Bill and Hillary, looked forward to setting a precedent that applies to everyone.
Peter Bowes, thank you.
It's 6:13 now. Children with cancer are going to have the cost of their travel to hospital for treatment paid as part of a new scheme that will not be means tested, unlike the current one. Sophie Hutchinson is our health correspondent. Sophie, tell us more.
Well, look, this is a £10 million fund which is being set up to pay the travel costs of young cancer patients and their families in England. Almost 2,000 children every year are diagnosed with cancer in England, and they have to go for treatment at specialist centres like Alderhay in Liverpool or Great Ormond Street Hospital in London. And sometimes it depends on the type of cancer they have as to where they actually go. There are 13 centres in England, so very often families are travelling long distances at substantial costs in, say, petrol and tickets. And the charity Young Lives Against Cancer estimates that on average, those families are travelling 350 miles a month and spending £250. And it says some families are being forced to weigh up whether to spend money on essential bills or take out loans to pay for that transport. And in the cases of some young people who might not be being supported by their parents, some have actually decided not to continue treatment. So the government is hoping, and so is this charity, that this will mean a big change, a big positive change in terms of young people and children with cancer.
And Sophie, on a different topic, we're hearing from the BMA later in the programme because they have voted to give resident doctors the ability to carry on their strike action. This is while talks are happening, because we both sides said there was going to be a big New Year push to try and resolve the pay dispute.
Yeah, there certainly is a sense of a slightly more positive sounding feeling and tensions not being as raised as they have been in the past. Both sides have been in negotiations and will stay in negotiations. They've been negotiating for the past month. Ministers tried to ease resident doctors' unhappiness by expanding the number of training posts by 4,000. And they're also aiming to enshrine in law the prioritisation of British trained doctors for jobs. But the big sticking point is pay. The government's given resident doctors an almost 30% pay rise over 3 years. It's offering now an additional 2.5% this year. But doctors are angry. They say 2.5% is a cut because it's below inflation. And they say they're still earning a fifth less than in 2008, and they want a plan to restore their salaries back to previous levels. Now, talks, as I say, are expected to continue, but there has been this vote, obviously, this mandate now for a possibility of a strike over the next 6 months. And in terms of whether there may be strikes in the future, I doubt any NHS trust is going to throw out its strike action contingency plan yet.
Sophie Hutchinson, thank you.
16 minutes past six. There is a new $1 trillion deal in the offing. In fact, it is going to happen because it's Elon Musk and it's SpaceX that he owns, of course, buying his artificial intelligence company XAI, which includes the social media platform X. Sean has more on that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Sean.
Hi, Justin. Yeah, so Elon Musk calling this business an innovation engine, this combined business. As he said, space-based AI is obviously the only way to scale. So it means that the rockets and the internet from space Starlink businesses at SpaceX are valued at around $1 trillion now. And that will combine with this AI business that's responsible for the chatbot Grok, owns the social media platform X, as Justin says, as well. He's got, separately, the $1 trillion Tesla car manufacturing business that, well, debate about whether it is about a car manufacturing business or not these days. Is it focusing more on robotics in the future? Elon Musk certainly tells us he thinks it will, and itself invested in XAI last month. Emma Wall is chief investment strategist at Hargreaves Lansdown. Emma, what's the plan here? Good morning, Emma. Do we have you on the line?
Good morning, Sean. Apologies.
Don't worry. We've got you, Emma. So, Elon Musk, with the technology, with the AI, with the rockets all under one roof, what's the game here?
Well, it's a $1.25 trillion company, according to the valuation of the deal. And the reason why it's valued that high is because really Elon is very much the market leader when it comes to two incredibly frontier technologies, and that's of AI and of space exploration. And in bringing these two together, he's really looking to leverage the technology that has fueled not just these businesses, but also his previous businesses in order to sort of dominate this sphere. You know, you spoke about the success of Tesla. We had their results last week in which he very much said it was no longer going to be an electric vehicle business, but it was going to be one of AI and automation. And it's those types of technologies that he'll be looking to leverage with this new kind of super company. What's interesting about this company is it's entirely private. So these valuations are... haven't been tested by the market in the same way that his sort of publicly listed business Tesla has. But what you're seeing priced in at these valuations is a kind of multi-decade vision for the company to put, you know, sort of energy generation into space, data centers into space. But the benefits we won't see, you know, on the earth for kind of 10, 20, 30 years.
So how do investors view something like this? Because even though it's a private company, you know, he'll need sort of backing of investors very much along the way. Are they going to be convinced that this is worth them putting their money into this, given the length of time you say it might well take for Elon Musk's plans to come to fruition?
Well, it's a very important question, and one that will become even more pointy because it's highly rumoured that Elon Musk will be looking to take this new combined entity public, so IPOing in June being very auspicious because it's the month in which sort of three planets align, and he likes to sort of think about these things when making business decisions. The thing about Musk is he has been tried and tested when it comes to the multi-decade vision. Most CEOs think in a kind of 3 to 5 year business cycle. But you know, Musk has done this before. When you think about when he first launched Tesla, the concept of autonomous vehicles was very much a sci-fi one. And now we do see them on the streets in America, and, you know, with plans for kind of for global distribution as well. So, you know, investors will be looking at his past record of having these multi-decade visions and his execution. And the valuation in June will be key to see what multiple people are willing to pay in order for that kind of long-term benefit. But certainly Musk has done it before and he could potentially do it again.
Right, so this will continue to possibly be the blockbuster deal of 2026. Just before we say goodbye, Emma, the commodity world, gold, silver, bouncing back a little bit after those big falls, it seems, this morning.
Yeah, we could have a daily show on the gold price at the moment. I mean, at one point it was up near 30% in sort of 3 weeks to $5,500 an ounce. Now it came back quite a lot, you know, dropping sort of 13% at the end of last week. Yesterday, we did see the gold price rise 4.2%. So it's now settled around 4,800. That was because people just considered it, after quite a considerable drop at the tail end of last week, a really interesting buying opportunity. We think the gold price volatility will continue through the year. It'll be very much linked to the uncertainty around geopolitics, the uncertainty around kind of Trump's trade tariffs, and we don't think that's going away anytime soon, unfortunately.
Emma, thank you. Emma Wall from Hargreaves Lansdown. Now, in the world of aviation, more than 1,400 commercial aircraft deliveries worldwide were made in 2025. So that's the highest year-to-date delivery for the past 7 years. That's according to data compiled by the Trade Association for the UK's Aerospace, Defence, Security and Space Industries, 25% increase on the year before. We can go to the Singapore Air Show now, where Darren Holst joins us, who's Vice President at Boeing. Darren, thank you for your time. At Boeing, your chief executive has had to talk a lot in the last year or so about repairing trust. How has the run of issues that Boeing has seen impacted your order book and an ability to deliver?
Oh, thanks for having me on. In terms of where we are, last year we secured over 1,000 orders, actually close to 1,100 orders, which was more than triple what we had in 2024. And I think it reflects demand for our products as well as just the overall health of the airline industry today.
How do you balance that at Boeing? Because, even this morning, just in the last hour or so, we're hearing latest developments from Air India. So the engineering team at Air India, Reuters is reporting, says it's escalated a matter to Boeing for priority evaluation after a potential switch defect in a plane. So Air India grounded a Boeing Dreamliner yesterday. These issues continue to have to be dealt with by Boeing.
Well, I defer to Air India on that. And of course, we're working and supporting them on all of their operations. But I would say that we're confident in the safety of our products and continue to work with all of our operators.
Is that being felt right across the board by those operators who may be looking to do deals with you? Because, of course, these, you know, the fuel switch issue that we're hearing about again in the last 24 hours is very much one that came up in the crash that involved the Air India Dreamliner last year that killed 260 people. So are you convincing airlines and customers around the world that you're on top of this?
I'm not really going to comment on that specifically. I think that deserves, you know, its own discussion. And I'd really rather focus on the demand for our products and what they're doing in the market today.
Okay. But I mean, when you see literally developments this morning about Air India having questions about a plane, I'm sure you would rather focus on that. But in your position, it must be a question that you're having to deal with on a regular basis, given the last few years.
We're in daily discussions with all of our customers, and I said I think this is probably better a discussion for Air India, and let this really focus on the operation of the aircraft.
And just finally then, Darren, as part of these numbers that we get about deliveries, they talk about a record number of backlog orders as well across the industry. So more than 16,000 aircraft across the industry. It's something you've talked about at Boeing in your latest financial results. Why do backlogs seem to grow?
Well, there's a couple factors. I think the major thing you talked about is over the last 7 years, because of the supply chain challenges, because of the impact of the pandemic, which took the industry, frankly, a long time to recover from, we've delivered about 2,000 fewer aircraft than the industry and the airlines around the world truly needed. And so in addition to normal growth demand, we've got a backlog of replacement aircraft that we need to deliver to the market to help them achieve efficiency goals. Today's aircraft are about 20% more efficient than the airplanes they'll be replacing. And that ongoing growth, as an industry, airlines are about 15% larger than they were before the pandemic, and we're still only 75 to 80% of where we were in 2018.
Darren Holse, Vice President at Boeing there. Now, the government has unveiled this morning a new framework to tackle what's called PFAS contamination. Forever chemicals. There's over 10,000 of these chemicals used in everything from essential medical equipment to waterproof clothing. The growing concerns about their impact on the environment and our health are not new concerns, but the government's plan includes encouraging the development of safer alternatives for the everyday items that rely on these chemicals. I've got Tim Fish with me, product director at RAB and Low Alpine Outdoor Clothing. And they've been working on phasing out these forever chemicals for more than a decade now. Tim, morning to you. Are these chemicals good for waterproof and warmth?
Good morning. Historically, yeah, the performance benefits that you get from using PFAS in outdoor apparel and equipment have been amazing. They perform really well. Obviously, there's been a lot of a growing awareness over the last couple of decades about the negative effects, though.
And so does it mean as you move away from them, the quality of the product is different?
I think the quality is different, but that doesn't mean that it's not as good. So one of the reasons that we've not been able to do like an overnight switch away from using PFAS is it takes time to engineer and develop alternatives that will still deliver as good a performance benefit as you used to get from PFAS.
But to a customer buying a jacket, and they might, you know, it might be the kind of thing where people stick with their brand a little bit. Do you find that some of your customers are arriving buying something that doesn't have the same chemicals it once did and realizing it maybe doesn't do the job it once did?
Yeah, it's a really good point. It does do the same job, but it does it differently. So I think the real need here is for a bit of consumer education and an increased awareness about how, as we and the industry moves away from PFAS, people need to look after and care for their outdoor apparel differently. So things like washing, reproofing, and making sure that you care for your product differently. So you'll get the same performance benefit, just in a different way. You need to be a bit more careful about it.
Does it cost more? No,
the end product costs the same. I think as we get to PFAS compliant products and materials being the norm, the cost is the same. It has cost us more. We don't always pass that on to the end consumer because we know it's the right thing to be doing.
Tim Fish, thank you. Product director there at RAB and Low Alpine Clothing.
Thank you, Sean. It's 28 minutes past six. Carthy's here with the sport. Morning.
Morning. Thank you very much. Sunderland beat Burnley 3-0, which moves them up to eighth place in the Premier League table. Their manager, Regis Labrisse, had particular praise for players returning from the Africa Cup of Nations, describing them as adding a new freshness to his squad and contributing to their position in the top half of the table.
36 points now, it's a good target, and we need 5-6 more points to make sure that we'll be in this league next season, but it's not achieved, so we'll have a tough week, you know, Arsenal away, then Liverpool at home, FA Cup at the end of the week, so new exciting challenges.
The Premier League had its quietest ever winter transfer deadline day with just 7 deals completed yesterday. Crystal Palace made the biggest signing of the final day of the transfer window. Striker Jorgen Strand Larsen moving from Wolves to Palace in a club record deal worth up to £48 million on a 4.5-year deal. The BBC Sport website and app has all of the completed transfer news. England will get their Six Nations campaign underway without their captain Mario Itoje on the pitch for the first time in almost 7 years. Itoje will be on the bench for England's opening game against Wales after missing their pre-tournament camp to go to his mother's funeral. The England captain has talked about the emotional fatigue of his grief, and the England head coach Steve Borthwick said they decided it was best for Itoje to start from the bench.
I think he's going to have a massive impact, and I'm excited by the impact our bench will have, and I'm also know that the Allianz Stadium crowd, when Mauro comes to the touchline, I'm sure that the roar he gets, that they'll show their appreciation, how much they care for him and his family also.
Jamie George will lead England from the start, with Itoje to take on the role when he comes off the bench. The British tennis number one, Emma Raducanu, won her first round match against Belgium's Greet Minnen without a coach at the Transylvania Open in straight sets. After the match, Raducanu admitted that she's finding the conditions in Romania a little easier than at the Australian Open.
I do think the matches and trainings in Australia helped me to feel I'm in a, you know, better, more sharp situation now here in Cluj. But I would say just first-strike tennis, that's what it's all about these days in the game. I feel like if you're not aggressive, then any half chance, the girls are on you.
Emma Finucane set a new world record for the women's flying 200-metre time trial at cycling's Track Elite European Championships in Turkey. And Sussex County Cricket Club has been given a 12-point deduction for the 2026 County Championship season following sustained operating losses in the last financial year. The club has also been docked a point each for the T20 Blast and the One Day Cup competitions.
Carthy, thank you.
The hunt for Lord Sugar's new business partner is on.
The next 12 weeks will be the toughest of your life.
And this year's candidates are going to bring in the money.
We can go in at 10K.
For $10,000, we'd expect a private jet to the pyramids.
What?
Going to take on the world.
We're running about Hong Kong and it's absolutely chaotic.
Going to face the music.
One of the worst performances in the history of this process. You're fired.
The Apprentice. Watch on BBC iPlayer.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster. And at 29 minutes to 7, it's time for a summary of the news with Alan Smith.
The Metropolitan Police is reviewing allegations that Lord Mandelson leaked sensitive government information to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein while he was a senior minister in Gordon Brown's cabinet. Downing Street said it stood ready to provide the police with whatever support was needed. Lord Mandelson has not responded to requests for comment. The former US President Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary have said they will testify before a congressional investigation into Epstein. The decision suspends a vote by lawmakers on whether to hold the couple in contempt for previously refusing to appear. A spokesperson for the Clintons said they looked forward to setting a precedent that applies to everyone. Sarah Ferguson's charity Sarah's Trust has announced it will close. The latest documents related to Jeffrey Epstein have included emails suggesting the former Duchess of York was in contact with the convicted paedophile while he was in prison and visited him shortly after his release. In a statement, the charity said the closure had been under discussion for some months. BBC News has approached Sarah Ferguson for comment. There have been more Russian airstrikes overnight on Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, targeting energy infrastructure during freezing temperatures. The Ukrainian authorities say they had to cut heating to some homes during the hours-long attack to protect the wider network. The government has drafted its first ever UK plan aimed at tackling the levels of harmful so-called forever chemicals, or PFAS, that contaminate water, soil and animals. Ministers will consult on whether to introduce a legal limit on PFAS in drinking water, which would allow regulators to take action when levels are exceeded. More Palestinians are expected to pass through the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt, which has reopened after being largely closed for much of the war. Five sick wounded patients and their companions left Gaza yesterday for medical treatment. And the government will cover the travel costs of families in England who have children with cancer to and from appointments. The £10 million funding has been welcomed by charities who say it will remove barriers to accessing treatment.
Thank you for that. 27 minutes to seven is the time. Did Peter Mandelson pass on market-sensitive secret information to Jeffrey Epstein at the height of the financial crisis? If he did, then what are the political, what are the legal ramifications? Let's talk to Henry Zeffman, our chief political reporter. Just on the legal side of it, Henry, several people, haven't they, have called for the police to be involved. What do we know at the moment about what they're doing?
The Metropolitan Police are looking at this. They are not at this stage investigating. They are reviewing the information to see if it meets the criminal threshold for investigation. As you say, lots of people now calling for them to investigate, calling for them to investigate specifically misconduct in public office. Now, that is a crime which potentially carries a sentence of life imprisonment. And I think gets to the point that it is hard to overstate how serious this is for Peter Mandelson. I mean, when we were speaking on this programme 24 hours ago, this just appeared to be a new iteration, a more vivid iteration of the same story we've discussed before, of terrible judgment from Lord Mandelson to remain friends with a convicted paedophile and of the political consequences thereof. But as people combed through the millions of files released by the US government yesterday, it became clear that there is potentially something more serious. And those accusations of misconduct in public office stem from some of the documents appearing to suggest, as you say, that Lord Mandelson had passed sensitive government information to Jeffrey Epstein when he was effectively Deputy Prime Minister. Just worth stating, while we've had responses from Lord Mandelson on some of the allegations stemming from these files, we haven't had a response from him on those allegations.
And how far then is the judgment, I mean, not just of Keir Starmer, but actually the judgment of previous Labour government, the judgment in a sense of everyone in Labour who has been associated with Peter Mandelson, also under the spotlight?
Yeah, it absolutely is under the spotlight in exactly the way you say. I mean, one of the more interesting elements to yesterday was this blistering statement from Gordon Brown, who wrote to the cabinet secretary demanding that he investigate the disclosure of confidential and market sensitive information by Lord Mandelson when he was business secretary. Of course, it is Gordon Brown who had a complicated multi-decades relationship with Lord Mandelson, but who installed him as business secretary and then as his sort of number two towards the end of his time as prime minister. Now, interestingly, Gordon Brown revealed that he had previously asked for an inquiry by the government in September last year, but that in November they told him they couldn't find any communications from Mandelson to Epstein. So almost as a side note, that means some of these questions, which were fresh to many of us yesterday, were ricocheting around at least one part of government 5 months ago. But you're right, this does, I think, strike an emotional blow for a massive segment of the Labour Party and of its current power brokers. Peter Mandelson was an influential, almost quasi-mentor figure to more than one generation of figures on the right of the Labour Party. That includes several people who are now at the heart of this government, including Morgan McSweeney, the Prime Minister's chief of staff. I think some of those people I was speaking to yesterday who've had long relationships with Lord Mandelson were bewildered by what some of these documents appear to suggest. Well, I think they are going to face more questions of judgment as this week progresses.
Henry Zeffman, thank you.
It's 23 minutes to seven. More Palestinians are expected to cross through Rafah between Egypt and Gaza when it reopens for the second day this morning. But a smaller than expected number managed to complete that journey yesterday. Yolande Nell is our Middle East correspondent. Yolande, we talked to you yesterday morning when those final preparations were happening. What did unfold yesterday?
I mean, we had thought that there would be slow progress in the Rafah crossing getting going again, but really it was extremely slow with a lot of delays, a lot of security restrictions. The World Health Organization said this was the first medical evacuation that took place on this route since May of last year. And in the end, only five Palestinians left from the Gaza Strip with seven companions. That was a process that basically took all day. We got footage of them coming out in the night in ambulances. One man, Mahmoud, in his 30s, a leukemia patient, said that he felt lucky. People who were returning to Gaza were those who had fled earlier in the war, people who had left for medical treatment coming back, and only about 12 were allowed back. We'd expected 50 to go in each direction. But there are reports that, you know, other people slept on the Egyptian side of the crossing. They were unable to complete the procedures to go into the territory that Israel now controls. You've got Egyptian and Israeli vetting taking place for anyone going through this crossing. Then you've got these European Union Border Patrol officers basically supervising the crossing inside, accompanied by Palestinian officials. And those coming in face the most stringent Israeli checks at a separate checkpoint. And to put this into perspective, Anna, I mean, local health officials in Gaza, these figures that broadly tally with what we have from the World Health Organization, they say there are 20,000 patients, including 4,500 children, waiting to leave Gaza for medical treatment.
And it seems symptomatic, Yolande, of the slow progress of this second phase of the deal. We saw last night the Israeli Prime Minister's office objecting to the logo that the National Committee for the Administration of Gaza is going to use. There are just lots of little things that keep coming up and making progress, as you were describing there, extremely slow.
That's right. I mean, that spat with the Israeli Prime Minister's office and the new technical committee that's supposed to go in to govern Gaza day to day is about them using the same logo as the Palestinian Authority, which governs parts of the occupied West Bank, in an official press release. And of course, the Israeli government has made clear it does not want to see the Palestinian Authority involved in the running of the Gaza Strip. The second phase is so much more complicated than the first, and the first has been so difficult to get across the line. It's also supposed to involve deploying an international stabilization force. We don't have news on which countries are going to send their troops in on the ground. Ultimately, there are supposed to be steps to start rebuilding in Gaza. We're not really seeing signs of that yet. And this, you know, key issue of disarming Hamas, how will that happen? We've got the US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff expected to arrive in Israel today to meet the Prime Minister, to meet Israeli military and intelligence chiefs. That looks to be mostly ahead of his meeting with the Iranian Foreign Minister on Friday, but they're also expected to talk about these complicated second phase issues.
Yolande Nell, thank you.
It is exactly 20 to 7. The Scottish Government's policy of housing some biological males who identify as transgender in women's prisons is being challenged today in court. Lorna Gordon's our Scotland correspondent who's on the line. Where does the challenge come from, Lorna, and what are they wanting to say?
Well, it's all to do with the Scottish Prison Service policy to do with the management of transgender people in custody. That was amended after Isla Bryson, who was a transgender woman, but a biological male who was previously known as Adam Graham, was found guilty of the rape of two women, initially sent to a women's prison. The prison service tightened the rules off the back of that, but they still allow for transgender women to serve sentences in the female estate in some instances. We think the transgender population in the Scottish prisons is small, around 19 people, but we don't know where they are placed and what they are convicted of. And Four Women Scotland want to challenge that guidance. They're going to court. They say it is illegal in light of the Supreme Court judgment back in April that bases that says on the basis of the Equality Act, they have to use a biological sex to determine someone's sex.
And meanwhile, Scottish Labour, Lorna, seem to have completely altered their position on all of this.
Yeah, they have. I mean, you know, John Swinney, the Scotland's First Minister, the SNP First Minister, has called this a difficult decision. He says he accepts the Supreme Court ruling that for the purposes of the equality law, sex is based on biology, but that the Scottish Government has determined that prison policy does not need to be changed. Anna Sawa, the leader of Scottish Labour, has said just within the last day or two that he would act swiftly if he were to win the election in May to ensure sure that prisons are single sex based on biological sex. He has said that it is clear the Equality Act needs to be respected. The Conservatives have said Anna Sowa has a brass neck. They point out that he whipped his MSPs to back the Gender Recognition Act, backing self-ID. And they say, and they point out that it was the Conservative UK government that blocked the Gender Recognition Reform Bill. So there's, you know, very clear political positions emerging, Labour changing theirs, a possibility that this ruling could come back before the Holyrood election in May, and entirely possible, of course, that this could become an election issue on the doorstep as well.
Lorna Gordon, thank you.
Peter Mandelson's links to the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein really dominating the front pages of the papers this morning. The Daily Mirror says Mandelson police probe Epstein links. That is, of course, linked to the fact that the Metropolitan Police are now going to look at those and see if there is a case to answer. The Financial Times: Starmer wants Mandelson out of Lords for leaking sensitive policies to Epstein. This is the Prime Minister saying that he strongly believes that Peter Mandelson should not be in the Lords anymore, but the government not at this stage moving an Act of Parliament that would enforce that. Lord Mandelson himself has spoken to the Times this morning. I was too trusting, he says in an exclusive interview, addressing some of what has come out of the latest tranche of files, but not all of them. In that particular interview, the Daily Mail says Labour's dark lord now faces a criminal inquiry. They have reprinted on their front page this morning that picture of Peter Mandelson in his underwear at Jeffrey Epstein's flat in Paris.
Worth mentioning one other story that you just feel, or certainly the paper that covers it feels, is something that might lead to floodgates opening. A young woman, according to the Daily Mail, had her breasts cut off by doctors while a teenager delivers a boy, has won £1.5 million in compensation for her suffering. It is what the Mail calls a landmark New York court decision, and this is the crucial thing, it's expected to spark potentially thousands of similar lawsuits in those countries. The Mail mentions Britain and the US that have enthusiastically embraced transgender ideology. Campaigners believe the case, which was brought by Fox Varian, who's now 22, will hail the end of a massive medical and social experiment on youngsters who believed that they were born in the wrong body.
And it's not just the front pages of the papers this morning that focus on Lord Mandelson. There were more questions for ministers about his links to the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein yesterday in Parliament. Several MPs demanded that the government pass a law to strip him of his peerage. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Alicia McCarthy.
Sir Keir Starmer had come to the Commons to update MPs on his recent trip to China and Japan. But the Lib Dem leader, Sir Ed Davey, wanted answers about something else, the growing swirl of accusations around his former ambassador to Washington, Lord Mandelson.
And yet again, Mr Speaker, the Prime Minister had to spend time on a foreign trip responding to revelations about the vile paedophile and sex trafficker Jimmy Epstein and his relationship with Lord Mandelson. The Prime Minister has rightly said that Mandelson should resign from the other place. But since he hasn't, will he back a simple piece of legislation to strip him of his peerage?
Among the documents released over the weekend were emails appearing to show that Lord Mandelson had forwarded internal and financially sensitive government information to Jeffrey Epstein. Sir Keir Starmer sidestepped the question from Ed Davey, so the SNP's Westminster leader Stephen Flynn had another go.
Does he agree with myself that Peter Mandelson should be subject to a police investigation for potential criminality whilst in public office?
Keir Starmer didn't answer that question either, telling MPs he was there to make a statement on his China trip. But a short time later, the Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister, Darren Jones, did give the government's view.
It is an understatement, Madam Deputy Speaker, to say that his decision to continue a close relationship with a convicted paedophile, including discussing private government business, falls far below the standards expected of any minister. His behaviour was unequivocally wrong.
Darren Jones said the Prime Minister had asked the Cabinet Secretary to review all of Peter Mandelson's contacts with Jeffrey Epstein during his time as a government minister, but stripping him of his title would involve passing a complicated law. For the Conservatives, Alex Burkhardt reckoned the government couldn't hide from its responsibility in making Peter Mandelson ambassador in the first place.
This was a political appointment. It happened only because of political pressure. And so one of two things must be true, Madam Deputy Speaker. Either there was the most terrible failure of the vetting system, or the government chose to brush that vetting information away.
Darren Jones stressed that the person who had to take responsibility for any failing was Peter Mandelson, who has previously questioned the authenticity of the released documents, apologised to the victims, and said how he regrets his association with Jeffrey Epstein. But the Labour chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, Dame Emily Thornberry, wanted more action.
Peter Mandelson was given £50,000 by a notorious paedophile, and a few years later, he sent on market-sensitive information to Epstein, who worked for JP Morgan, about market bailouts, the Prime Minister's resignation, telling them that they should mildly threaten the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and then told him about matters of national security.
She didn't think it was a question of whether Peter Mandelson should be in the Lords.
This is a matter of whether the police should be involved.
Yeah.
A Conservative, Sir Julian Lewis, thought Darren Jones might be a little young to remember a famous photo opportunity way back in 1997.
When the late John Prescott compared Mandelson to a scorpion in a jam jar that he was holding. But can the minister explain to this House the fatal fascination of Labour leader after Labour leader in appointing this man to post after post with his chequered record of corruption and multiple resignations?
The creature in the large glass jar was in fact a crab, not a scorpion. But that didn't stop Conservative MPs enthusiastically cheering Julian Lewis's point. Darren Jones didn't rise to the bait, instead telling MPs...
Whether it's about Peter Mandelson or Michelle Moan or other peers who have brought the other place into disrepute, that there needs to be a process for the removal of members of the other place and their peerage.
A Lib Dem, Manuela Pertegella, focused on the girls as young as 14 who were trafficked, asking the minister to ensure that...
Any UK-linked offences will be fully investigated, that all evidence will be acted upon, and that anyone implicated, whatever their status, will be pursued with the full force of the law.
Darren Jones said anyone with information should make themselves available to investigators in the UK or overseas.
That was Alyssa McCarthy on Yesterday in Parliament. It brings us to 10 to 7, but let's stay on the subject of Peter Mandelson. If he doesn't resign his seat in the Lords, can he not simply be stripped of it and indeed of the title? Let us talk to Lord Garnier, Edward Garnier, who sat on the Lords Conduct Committee for several years, but also back in the day was Solicitor General. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Why is it that you can't, that this government seems to suggest that it can't simply strip Lord Mandelson of his title, and indeed other peers who have been accused of misbehaving?
Well, I guess it flows from how peers are created, and it will require an Act of Parliament. But actually, I think Emily Thornberry isn't entirely correct. That would be a complete diversion. The real question is what it demonstrates about the judgment of a number of prime ministers, but particularly this prime minister, in appointing him to the post in the embassy in Washington, and what it says about the questions about the ministerial code when Mandelson was in Gordon Brown's cabinet. We don't seem to have heard much about the ministerial code, but we have heard from Gordon Brown yesterday or the day before that he appears to be absolutely livid about what has happened. As regards the House of Lords Code of Conduct, of course, we'd have to look at the code of conduct which applied to Mandelson in 2008-2009 when he was a government minister in the House of Lords. The earlier stuff about receiving money from Epstein in 2003-4-5, whenever it was, he was either then a member of the House of Commons or a European Union commissioner. Different things apply.
Can I just interrupt you on that? Because I think for a lot of people listening, yes, there are various procedures to go through and they should be gone through. But actually it seems extraordinary to people that someone who misbehaves on the scale that Peter Mandelson is accused of misbehaving on, that it is extraordinary not only that they sit in the House of Lords, but also, actually, that they can't simply be stripped of their title. And I mean, I know you say it's not the central focus, but I think for a lot of people who look at the way in which the establishment runs itself, it actually is rather important that someone who has misbehaved on a grand scale is no longer able to call themselves Lord.
I can entirely understand that frustration, but I'm afraid we have to deal with the procedures that we've got. Clearly, it would be better if Lord Mandelson were to resign, and he could do that.
But even then, he'd be Lord Mandelson, wouldn't he?
Yes, he doesn't have to call himself Lord Mandelson. And frankly, I think the chances of ever coming back into the House of Lords are pretty slim to non-existent. He's more likely to go to Brazil than to come into the House of Lords.
But, I mean, and it's not just him. There are others as well, peers who are no longer in the House of Lords, but still have the right to call themselves Lord. And you're saying there is really nothing much, frankly, that any government can do about it.
No, and I think the thing to do is not to allow that to become a distraction. I entirely take your point that it is, to the public, that must be, and to me, for goodness sake, it's very frustrating that people who have misbehaved or who are worthy of investigation of whether they've misbehaved, should be allowed to continue calling themselves this, that, or the other. But one doesn't want to allow the Prime Minister and the government to use that as a distraction from their own naivety and gullibility in appointing the man in the first place. There are plenty of things that can be done, and the police are now investigating. Gordon Brown has asked the Cabinet Secretary to investigate what happened when he was Prime Minister and Mandelson was Business Secretary. But those will come up with, I would have thought, fairly quick responses. To allow oneself to get bound up and worried about whether he calls himself Lord this or that is I think, a distraction.
Right.
He will not legislate. He cannot legislate. He's on leave of absence by virtue of his taking the post as ambassador. So essentially he plays no part in the procedures of the House of Lords. And as I say, okay, if he ever stepped foot in the place, I think he'd be pretty smartly shown the door.
Lord Garnier, Edward Garnier, thank you. And we'll be talking to a government minister after 8.
6 minutes to 7, forever chemicals and what to do with them in the future will be discussed in the government's long-awaited plan, which is being published today. They are linked to a whole range of environmental and health concerns, so their use needs to change. Stephanie Metzger is policy advisor at the Royal Society of Chemistry. Good morning.
Hello.
What are we expecting to see here? What are the issues that need to be rectified?
So there's a few issues with PFAS. First of all, we are still learning about where they are in the environment and how we are exposed to them. And so the new plan looks to be ramping up the monitoring of PFAS, which is great. There's also an issue that a lot of times there's not very good alternatives to PFAS materials in some of the things that we use them for. And so we need to be innovating new solutions to make sure that we have alternatives to PFAS so we can move away from them as quickly as possible.
Mm, that's interesting. So in the meantime, we just keep using them, even if the technology that will replace them is slow to be developed.
I think there's different groups of things that we can, that will move at different timelines. So something like consumer products is probably an area that we can move a lot more quickly on. A lot of consumer products that use PFAS either don't really need the PFAS, or it will probably be not much of a difference in the performance of the product if you move from PFAS to something else. And so I think that's one area we can probably move away from a lot of PFAS uses fairly quickly. There are some higher tech or very highly specialized product uses that probably will take a little bit longer to find adequate solutions, such as in some electronics or some clean energy technologies. But these uses often tend to be also a lot more controlled. This is where looking at things like controlling the process of manufacturing and using these materials is really important to prevent emissions to the environment if we do need to take time to find alternative solutions.
Is this government plan, from what you've seen of it, going to do what it needs to do?
I think it's very comprehensive in the areas that it tries to address, but we are concerned certainly that it is a bit light on details and it doesn't have many timelines or, you know, targets in terms of how they're planning to actually operationalize the commitments that they're making. So I think it really signals the right intentions and the right direction of movement, but without the details and the plan of how they're going to take this plan into action, we'll have to wait and see if it's going to achieve what it intends to do.
Interesting. Because timelines are key, because going back to what we were saying, if there's not a timeline, this continues to happen in the meantime.
Absolutely. And PFAS are already widespread in the environment. We're already exposed to them in many places in our day-to-day life. And so stopping, you know, further pollution is really important, but also we have to deal with what's already there as well. And so without any sort of timeline to see how things are going to change, it feels almost as if you know, these problems are going to continue building up. And with PFAS, they are persistent. They do build up over time. If we don't stop our exposure now, by the time we're seeing the effects, it might be too late to make a change.
Stephanie Metzger, policy advisor at the Royal Society of Chemistry. Thank you.
3 minutes to seven. And let us look ahead to tomorrow morning.
Sideways on BBC Radio 4. The ideas shaping our lives and how some people see the world differently.
I felt that instant tugging on the heartstrings when I heard the heartbeat of my own child.
In the new series, we challenge the notion that men can't be broody, question the everyday absurdities we've come to normalise, and ask if miracles are compatible with scientific thinking.
We heard you had a brain tumour. Have a seat and we'll pray for you.
Sideways with me, Matthew Side, starts tomorrow morning at 9. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
Simon King is here with the weather, which I'm going to characterise, Simon, as dreary. Is that fair?
That is very fair. I was going to say, again, you know, lots of cloud across the United Kingdom once again, with that some light and patchy rain, and cold enough for some to see some snow as well. So let's start off across Wales, southwest and southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England. Lots of cloud, a bit of hill fog around, and some patchy light rain at the moment. But the rain is likely to turn a little bit heavier and more widespread across parts of southeast England up into the Midlands during this afternoon. And then by this evening, we will start to see a little bit of snow falling over the higher ground of North Wales. Temperatures about 3 to 7 degrees, but locally up to about 11 degrees in the far southwest of England. Now, for northwest and northeast England, pretty overcast this morning. Again, some hill fog, a bit of light rain over the Pennines, but for most, a dry start to the day. We will see the possibility of a few snow showers coming into the hills of the Pennines later today, and temperatures of 3 or 4 degrees. For Northern Ireland, a cloudy day. A bit of light rain, likely more so this afternoon, highs of 4 to 6. And across northern and eastern Scotland, rain to low levels, but snow over higher ground. Significant accumulations here, strong southeasterly winds, about freezing, but for west in Scotland, drier and brighter, with highs of 6 or 7 degrees.
Simon, thank you. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Justin Webb.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 3rd of February. The headlines today: Lord Mandelson is facing a possible police investigation into allegations that he leaked sensitive government information to Jeffrey Epstein. Baroness Harman, who was leader of the House of Commons at the time, will join us live after the news. More Palestinians are expected to pass through the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt following its reopening. And Elon Musk is merging his space and artificial intelligence businesses, creating the world's largest private company, valued at more than $1 trillion.
Coming up in the next hour, we hear from teachers and students as the House of Lords prepares to debate whether there should be a law banning phones in schools.
That would help schools because we'd all be in the same boat. It would be fair, and then we'd more likely to get the buy-in from the parents and the families.
I would prefer to have my phone on me just in case that there might be an emergency, like at home.
We'll be talking to the former Ofsted Chief Baroness Spielman. Also, our science editor is going to explain why NASA has had to stop its dress rehearsal for the launch of the Artemis 2 mission, which was set to take astronauts around the moon. It seems not yet. The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
The government has said it'll provide whatever assistance is needed as the Metropolitan Police considers accusations that Lord Mandelson passed sensitive government information to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Scotland Yard said last night it was reviewing allegations of misconduct in a public office. Documents released by the US authorities appear to show Epstein was sent details of internal discussions from the heart of the UK government. Our political correspondent Nick Eardley reports.
The latest files released by the US Department of Justice provide evidence of just how close the relationship between Lord Mandelson and Jeffrey Epstein was. When he was business secretary, Lord Mandelson appeared to share a message written by an aide to the then Prime Minister Gordon Brown discussing the possible sale of government assets. He also appeared to confirm plans for a €500 billion bailout by Eurozone countries. After calls for police to investigate, the Metropolitan Police said last night that it was reviewing reports of alleged misconduct to determine if they met the criminal threshold for investigation. Lord Mandelson has not responded to requests for comment about the allegations. The government said it would provide whatever support and assistance the police needed. Lord Mandelson also continues to face pressure to step down from the House of Lords, with the government saying he should no longer be a member of the chamber.
The former US President Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary have agreed to testify in the congressional investigation into Jeffrey Epstein. The couple had faced the possibility of being held in criminal contempt of Congress after refusing requests to appear in person before lawmakers. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
Bill and Hillary Clinton say they've already provided all the relevant information they have about Jeffrey Epstein and his accomplice Ghislaine Maxwell in the form of written statements. In an emailed declaration, the former president acknowledged that he flew on Epstein's private plane several times, explaining that the trips were in connection with the work of the Clinton Foundation. He has denied any knowledge of Epstein's criminal conduct. But now, just before a scheduled vote by the House of Representatives to decide whether to hold the couple in criminal contempt, they have agreed to answer the committee's questions in person. Their spokesperson said the Clintons look forward to setting a precedent that applied to everyone.
Last night, Sarah Ferguson's charity Sarah's Trust announced it was closing for the foreseeable future after new revelations emerged about the former Duchess of York's friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. Emails from the latest release of documents suggest she was in contact with Epstein while he was in prison and visited him at his Palm Beach mansion with her daughters Beatrice and Eugenie just days after he was released. Sarah Ferguson has been approached for comment. More people are expected to pass through the Rafah crossing between the Gaza Strip and Egypt after its reopening yesterday. Only a few patients have managed to get out of Gaza to Egypt for medical treatment so far. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell.
The reopening of the Rafah crossing marked a key step in the Israel-Hamas ceasefire, but so far it's been mostly a symbolic one. No goods are allowed to pass through, and on the first day that people were permitted to cross, only a handful made it. Five patients left with companions and 12 people were allowed to return, falling far short of the 50 officials had said would be able to travel in each direction. About 20,000 Palestinians needing medical care are hoping to leave the devastated territory, while tens of thousands more are waiting to enter and return home. Palestinian officials blame delays on Israeli security checks, but there was no immediate comment from Israel's military.
The government has drawn up its first ever national plan to tackle the harmful so-called forever chemicals found in the environment. They're known as PFAS and are used in many everyday products such as non-stick pans and waterproof fabrics, but accumulate in water, soil and animals, causing contamination. The plan includes ramping up nationwide testing. Emma Hardy is the Environment Minister.
We have a problem in this country of legacy contamination because of our industrial past and the way that we've manufactured things, as well as how we manufacture things today. So we want to understand what more about them, how we can reduce our use of them, and how we can get rid of them.
Elon Musk is merging his rocket company SpaceX with his artificial intelligence firm xAI, expanding the world's most valuable private company. The billionaire said the combined firm would work to install AI data centers in space where they could harness power from the sun while avoiding the expense of cooling. From New York, here's our North America business correspondent Michelle Fleury.
The move brings SpaceX, the xAI chatbot Grok, and the social media platform X into a single company. The combined business is expected to be worth more than $1 trillion. Mr. Musk said the deal marks a new phase in the mission of SpaceX and xAI. He described it as the next book, not just the next chapter. The announcement could also support his ambition to place data centres in space. They would be used to handle large amounts of AI computing. Mr. Musk, the largest shareholder in SpaceX, has been streamlining his businesses ahead of a potential stock market listing. The world's richest person is reportedly considering taking SpaceX public.
NASA has been conducting final tests on its Artemis II rocket ahead of its planned first crewed flyby mission to the moon in more than 50 years. There are reports a fuel leak has been detected, which may delay the planned launch. Children and young people with cancer in England will have the cost of their travel for treatment paid for through a new government scheme. Ministers say the £10 million fund will support families who often face long and frequent journeys to specialist centres. Our health correspondent Sophie Hutchinson reports.
Almost 2,000 children and young people diagnosed each year with cancer in England need to travel to specialist centres for treatment. This often results in them making multiple long journeys, which the charity Young Lives Against Cancer estimated could cost on average £250 a month. Some families can claim back their travel expenses under a means-tested scheme, but many can't. Some say they've taken out loans, cut back on food, and fallen behind with their bills. The new government scheme will cover the travel costs of all young people up to the age of 24 by 2027.
A debate is being held in the House of Lords on a potential ban on smartphones in schools. The government has recently strengthened its guidance to make clear that all schools should be phone-free environments for the whole day. But some teachers have called for that to be made law. Here's our education reporter, Vanessa Clark.
Just 2 weeks ago, peers in the House of Lords passed an amendment to the Children's Wellbeing in Schools Bill to ban social media for under-16s. Today, they will debate a smartphone ban in schools. Current guidance says schools should be phone-free environments and most already restrict their use, although policies vary from school to school. Around 650 child protection professionals have signed an open letter to the Prime Minister calling for a ban, but headteachers warn any legal ban would have to include exemptions, for example for medical reasons, and that many students use their smartphones travelling to and from school. The government is looking at phone use in schools as part of its three-month consultation on social media for under-16s. If today's vote passes, it would still need parliamentary approval.
And Doctor Who fans can bid for a piece of television history in an online auction of props from the BBC sci-fi series, which opens today. More than 300 lots are up for grabs, including costumes, three sonic screwdrivers, a Dalek and a TARDIS.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. It is 9 minutes past seven now. The police are reviewing emails about government policy that Lord Mandelson sent to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein when he was a minister. He's previously apologised for what he described as ill-advised friendship with the disgraced financier, but things have now moved on a step with several political parties reporting him for potential misconduct in public office. The nature of what he shared was commercially sensitive and it shouldn't have been passed on, but it was. Baroness Harman joins me in the studio this morning, who was Leader of the Commons and Deputy Labour Leader when Peter Mandelson was Business Secretary. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you feel that the current Labour leadership have got a real handle on public feeling when it comes to this? How angry people are? Because they talk about, well, he won't come back to the Lords again and it would be too difficult to strip the peerage. Do you think they really understand how upset people are about this?
Well, I'm sure they are, because what's happened and what's so terrible about what Peter Mandelson's done is it's played into the sense that people have that politicians are all the same, we're all in it for ourselves, we're in it for money. And that is not the case, but what Peter Mandelson has done is cast a stain over not just this government, but over politics as a whole. And I'm sure the government are in absolute no doubt about the seriousness of it and will be taking action, and Peter Mandelson will be held accountable. But I think more than that, the government need to get on with their manifesto commitments to building trust in politics by implementing further measures that are in the manifesto to clean up politics.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that, actually. And I just wonder, though, when Sir Keir Starmer appointed Lord Mandelson to be ambassador to the US, at that point in time, his character, his integrity had been questioned multiple times before. And we have a situation where Gordon Brown, back in September, again, had raised concerns with the cabinet secretary. There is a sense that this was swirling around and nobody was really taking it seriously.
Well, I think that this has been a serial problem for Labour prime ministers. I mean, I was of the view that Peter Mandelson was untrustworthy from the 1990s, but he was appointed by Tony Blair. He was appointed by Gordon Brown and appointed again by Sir Keir Starmer. But even I, who had a view that he was untrustworthy, I could never have believed that Gordon Brown, having appointed him to the cabinet, he would sit in that cabinet and leak information whilst the government was struggling to protect the country from the global financial crisis. So even I have been shocked at the degree of his wrongdoing.
Yeah. Why do you think people like him get a free pass
over and over again, because it brings us back to your original point. I was in Gorton and Denton just a couple of days ago doing a piece about the by-election, and it really shone through the number of people who said, politicians, they're not like me. They don't understand me. They don't understand the real world. And when they see, as you identified there, subsequent Labour prime ministers giving important jobs to Peter Mandelson, it just reinforces that view.
Well, it's really depressing that people have that view, that lack of confidence, reinforced by what Peter Mandelson did. And after 40 years in the House of Commons, you know, it's firmly my view that the kind of corruption that's been displayed by Peter Mandelson is the exception. It is not the rule. But the government needs to make sure of two things. Firstly, that Peter Mandelson is held accountable, and he will pay the price, and I'm sure that will happen. But also the further steps that were foreshadowed in Labour's manifesto for cleaning up politics are now taken.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because even if he doesn't go to the Lords again, he still holds that title. And if we look back, for example, Lord Ahmed of Rotherham, convicted in 2022 of serious sexual offences against children in the 1970s. Lord Taylor of Warwick, convicted in 2011 of false accounting, as was Lord Hanningfield. Lord Archer of Weston-super-Mare, convicted in 2001 of perjury and perverting the course of justice, sentenced to 4 years imprisonment, all still able to call themselves Lords. This has been going on for decades, and the argument now is, well, the legislation isn't in place. But as you say, it was a manifesto commitment and nothing has happened.
Well, I think it certainly will happen now. And as you've said, it was in the manifesto, and there was a programme of reform of the House of Lords, the first part of which was removal of hereditary peers, which has been done. And the further proposal was a removal of disgraced members. So that was in the manifesto, and it will be got on with. And in the meantime, I think the Prime Minister could be advising the King to stop him being a Privy Councillor. And I also think that he's on leave of absence at the moment from the House of Lords, having stepped out of the House of Lords to be our ambassador. And I think it would be good for the Lords to pass a motion to say that he's not to reapply to come back in. But I think, ironically, this was foreshadowed, or at least the problems that have been identified in this horrific case were foreshadowed in our manifesto. And I have no doubt that the government will feel the impetus to get on it. But I also think they will feel the impetus that they need to reinforce in everyone's minds that violence and abuse and sexual abuse of young girls and women is absolutely at the heart of government's concerns, that we've got a manifesto commitment to halve violence against women and girls. And nobody should think that because of Peter Mandelson's preparedness to engage with and, in fact, help a convicted paedophile casts any doubt on the government's commitment about women and girls.
The Prime Minister has said that reform is a job for the Lords. But should a simple act of Parliament be brought in this case to strip Lord Mandelson of that title?
Well, I think it could be done concurrently. It could be that under the current procedure, the government bring in a bill to strip Peter Mandelson of his title of being a peer, but at the same time, the government bring forward, through the Lords, changed processes to actually modernise the rules in the House of Lords, because they've been modernised in the House of Commons in order for MPs to be removed, and that needs to happen in the House of Lords
because
as well.
Because there's some suggestion that doing, you know, bringing an Act of Parliament would be a waste of time. But it's not a waste of time. If it removes a peerage from somebody in that situation, it needn't be complex, as I understand it.
Well, I don't think it matters that a number of things are being done concurrently. There's the police investigation, there's the issue of his Privy Councillorship, there's the question of his readmission after temporary absence from the House of Lords, there's the question of primary legislation to strip him of his title, but there's also the question of changing the rules to make the House of Lords processes modern and much less cumbersome.
Baroness Harman, thank you for joining us this morning.
16 minutes past seven is the time. Resident doctors, we used to call them junior doctors, in England have voted to carry on their strike action. But there are also talks going on with the government. So let's talk to Dr. Arjun Nagra, who is the deputy chair of the BMA Resident Doctor Committee. Good morning to you.
Morning.
What have we reached then when it comes to whether or not we know that there is going to be further strike action? Is it simply that you have the right now to take that action? Are you saying that there are going to be strike days that you're going to target, or what?
So we've got a mandate to go on strike if we so wish, but there is no intention to go on strike. So it is, as with any other trade union, a negotiating tool, but we've got no intention of actually using it. I would actually say that our relationship with government over the last few months has become increasingly positive. We've got two disputes going on right now, a jobs dispute and a dispute on pay. The former, I think we are actually making some serious progress. The government's put forward a bill to prioritise UK graduates. That was very welcome. That's an excellent bill. That's going to see thousands of UK grads in work this year who otherwise wouldn't have been. So we are going in the right direction. And I think, you know, if we get in the room, we have some constructive talks and see where we go. But at the moment, there's no dates planned.
So if a deal can be done on the jobs, can the money be put into abeyance? Can the money be sorted separately?
How do you mean?
Well, in as much as can, if there is to be a deal and if there is an agreed deal on jobs, is that enough, I suppose, is the question?
No, I think there needs to be a deal on both. We've got a mandate on pay and jobs. And look, when we're talking about the jobs dispute, prioritising your own homegrown talent is the bare minimum. The government's done it. They've done it very quickly. And I welcome that change. They've done really well there. But we've got a long way to go on pay. But we will get in the room.
Sorry to interrupt, but just on that, how far? I mean, you say on jobs, you're pretty close and you've been very positive about that. On pay, what?
On pay, I think there's some way to go. We have had talks on pay and I think there is a framework there that we can build on. But, you know, as with most negotiations, they do cool down before the other side realises if you're going to have a mandate or not. That's natural. That's what anyone would do in their position. Now we've got a mandate that essentially lasts. It's a permanent mandate in reality because the next ballot will be online. We can, you know, pull the trigger and go on strike whenever we want, but that's not the aim of the game. The aim of the game is to get good pay, good conditions, and that is without strike action, hopefully.
Do you think at the moment it is likely that you will strike again?
I couldn't say. I don't think so. I think our talks have been constructive, but we will set timelines internally in the room. And if they're not met, then obviously we do have the leverage to call for strike action. We've been on strike, I don't know, 14, 15 times, quite a lot over the last 2 years. Ideally, we can get this done without any further action. The atmosphere in the room, I'd say, is quite positive. People are working in a constructive manner. So I'm hopeful. Maybe I'm being naively optimistic, but I am optimistic.
You called it a negotiating tool, which of course it is. For a lot of patients and potential patients and people waiting for treatment listening, that they will not appreciate that term because it's people's lives, isn't it? Does that change it at all? Does that change the balance of how willing you are to go on strike again?
It's a fact. It's a fact of the matter, unfortunate fact of the matter that that strikes are, you know, one of the very few things that we can do to move that yardstick. If we didn't need to, in an ideal world, we would never need to call for strike action. Paying conditions would improve year on year. That doesn't happen. So that's the reality of the situation. Regarding patient care, I think the care that patients receive in this country is not up to standards. The NHS was 10 years ago, a bit longer now, 15 years ago, a gold standard for healthcare that every other health system across the world would look at and model themselves on. That was the example of the best care. We don't have that anymore. One of the reasons, amongst many, is that we don't have sufficient doctors, and doctors don't feel valued. And as a result of not having enough doctors, patients don't get seen. As a result, patients come to harm. It's a vicious cycle that needs stopping. It starts with empowering your staff. I represent doctors. It starts with empowering doctors for us.
Dr. Arjun Nagra, Deputy Chair of the BMA Resident Doctors Committee. Thank you.
21 minutes past seven, chocolate prices shot up last year, but the price of cocoa is now at its lowest for more than 2 years, with Easter on the horizon. Positive news, Sean Farrington, for me at least.
Well, will it kick in before then? Because obviously it's a key ingredient, but supply chains, all that, and you know, particularly pertinent at Christmas, people will have noticed that 15% price rise of chocolate over the course of last year. When throughout the year we spoke of previous poor harvests in West Africa, for example, as one major reason contributing to cocoa prices previously being driven up, but in recent months they've been heading the other way. Jonathan Parkman is head of agricultural sales at the commodities brokerage Marex Group. Morning, Jonathan. Why the steady fall recently?
Good morning. Well, to a certain extent, production has recovered in West Africa, but that's only really part of the story. The main part of the story is a complete collapse in demand, a process of shrinkflation coupled with people not wanting to spend as much on chocolate as they have in the past has caused a big drop in the amount of consumption, something in the order of 10 to 15%.
To the extent we've turned away from chocolate to other products, have we?
Yes. One of the major chocolate makers did a study recently on the effect of chocolate demand of chocolate inflation against normal inflation. And we've had, as you've rightly pointed out earlier in the segment, that we've had huge chocolate inflation. That's beginning to reverse. The outlook in the future is certainly better. But that huge chocolate inflation has had a very negative effect on demand.
I mean, as Anna asked the question, I will ask it as well. In time for Easter, how does it work with supply chains and when customers might see the benefits of lower prices?
I think we're going to have to wait until Christmas, really. There's virtually no chance, well, in fact, not virtually no chance, there is no chance of seeing a significant reduction in chocolate prices before Easter or even for Easter. But around Christmas, the supply chain's probably locked in for about the next 8 months. And so today's price will be reflected probably in the fourth quarter of this season.
And what about a move back to cocoa where substitutes have been used? To such an extent, we were talking about toffee crisps no longer being called chocolate.
Yes, and I think that's really where what is likely to happen. I mean, the major chocolate manufacturers have gone through a process of reformulation to use less cocoa in their chocolate, but that can be reversed, and it's much easier to go back to an old formulation than it is to develop a new one. So that can be a relatively quick phase, but I'm only talking about the difference between a year and 2 years. So 8 months to a year down the line, we could certainly see more cocoa in our chocolate.
Jonathan, thank you very much, despite you not bringing Anna the news she was hoping to hear for her Easter shop. Jonathan Parkman there from, sorry, Anna, Marex Group.
Sure, thank you. 24 minutes past seven is the time. Over the last few weeks, as you know, we've been hearing from some of the best-known authors on the book that ignited or reignited their love of reading. It's part of our series marking the National Year of Reading. It is today the time of the four times Booker shortlisted author Ali Smith, known for works including How to Be Both and The Seasonal Quartet. She went above and beyond and wrote us actually an essay about the book that ignited her love of reading. So it's Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, first published in 1952 by Harper and Brothers.
So when I was 9 years old in primary six at St. Joseph's School in Inverness, I had a passionate argument with our teacher about whether a book was good or not. The teacher was Sister Vincent, and she was a great reader herself with very good taste and strong opinions, the kind that meant that she'd removed all the Enid Blyton from the class library because she believed her books were written not by Enid Blyton but by a factory of writers. Anyway, the day came round when the class was allowed to suggest the next book Sister Vincent would be reading out loud to us all, and I championed the book I had fallen completely in love with, about a pig and a spider, Charlotte's Web by E.B. White. Now, there'd been many books I'd loved before, but this one had swallowed my heart, then returned it to me bigger and stronger. But Sister Vincent put her foot down. No, she said. Why? I said. Because animals speak in it, and in reality, animals don't speak. Well, teachers are always right. Sister Vincent was always right. There was no point in me saying I felt this was an unjust interpretation. But then, this book was about injustice. Chapter 1, a bunch of baby pigs is born, including a runt. The owner gets his axe to kill it, and his daughter, who's 8, is outraged. If I had been very small at birth, would you have killed me? Her parents hear her and let her nurse this piglet to health. This is where something imaginative starts to happen. Sure enough, the pig starts to speak to the other creatures he lives with, who speak to him too and to himself. And throughout the book, you can't be quite sure whether this is coming from the mind of the girl or is really happening. He's quite an existential pig, I see now. Am I free? Is this freedom? He says. Why do I exist? I'm quite lonely. I wish I had a friend. Salutations! A thin and pleasant voice shouts down from the barn's rafters. It's a spider, born with a complex lexicon and a great formal politeness. She's quite a bloodthirsty friend to have. She eats flies, mosquitoes, anything that gets caught in her web. Of course, I don't really eat them, she says in her thin, pleasant voice. I drink them. More home truths. You're not going to exist for long, the oldest, wisest sheep advises the pig, just long enough to be big enough to be killed and eaten at Christmas. The pig is, as anyone would be, distraught. But his friend, the spider, promises him, I won't let you die. And she doesn't. She turns an inevitability around by nothing other than her skill with a few words. So this new year, I reread Charlotte's Web for the first time since I was 9. I wish I could talk about it to Sister Vincent now, wherever she is in the universe. Its attention to language's persuasiveness and power, who has language and who doesn't, how important it is to find the right word, how close writing has always been to transformatory magic. Never mind the gorgeous sensory descriptions of the barn, the turn of the seasons, the celebration of ordinariness, especially the satire the book spins on human gullibility in the advertising age. What a great start, not just to a year of reading, but a life of reading, because Charlotte's Web doesn't dodge the toughness in life. It addresses and assuages it word by word. Reading it, 50 years on, moved me and the 9-year-old still inside me to tears. Terrific, radiant, humble. What a book.
The thoughts of the 4 times Booker shortlisted author Ali Smith. It's 28 minutes past 7. Carthy's back with the sport. Hello again.
Morning. Thank you very much. Hello. Sunderland beat Burnley 3-0, which moves them up to 8th place in the Premier League table. And Crystal Palace made the biggest signing of the final day of the winter transfer window. Striker Jorgen Strand Larsen moving from Wolves to Palace in a club record 4-year deal with up to £48 million. Football headlines are all on the BBC Sport website. And there's more on England getting their Six Nations campaign underway without their captain Mario Tojo on the pitch on the website. Tojo will be on the bench for England's opening game against Wales on Saturday after missing their pre-tournament camp to go to his mother's funeral. Jamie George will lead England. Now, the golf Saudi-backed LIV Tour starts this week. It's been something of a disruptor to the PGA and European golf tours over the last 4 years, but some of LIV's golf's biggest names, like major winners Brooks Koepka and Patrick Reed, have left the league or have not signed contracts in the last few days. We're joined by the Telegraph's golf correspondent. Morning, James Corrigan.
Hi.
LIV Golf changed their format from 54 holes to 72 holes for this season. But why, given that they're being paid millions and they have a guaranteed income, are some of the biggest names defecting back to the PGA Tour?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's one that probably is vexing LIV a lot. What happens is, you know, the contracts are running out. LIV aren't paying as much money as they did at the start when they were signing them up. And in golf, it usually comes down to money. Brooks Koepka left, and he said there were good family reasons behind it. But he never really bought into the concept. I think he looked at the PGA Tour and was missing, you know, the big show. And the same with Patrick Reed. His contract was actually up, and he just loves playing golf, you know. And they only play 14 events a year, and he really wants to get back on the PGA Tour. You know, I think it's a crossroads for them. And I think LIV are finding out just how individually selfish golfers can be. You know, they preyed on this at the start when they launched this extraordinary venture, and now they're finding the other end of it.
Yeah, the financial rewards have been huge, and one of the biggest stars in golf, Bryson DeChambeau, 2-time major winner, huge social media following, has suggested he might not stay on the LIV Tour. Could that have a ripple effect?
Yeah, well, I think he would be the biggest domino of all. You know, he has a massive social media follow. He's probably their biggest draw after Mickelson. His contract is up. He feels that he's worth, well, the figures that have been reported are $500 million to sign up for another 4 or 5 years. You know, we're talking extraordinary numbers here. But I think he also misses it. They've all got egos, and they don't like the fact that their LIV hasn't cut through to the public. It's getting terrible TV viewing figures. The PGA Tour is on the up. They've had to raise their purses considerably in the wake of the LIV attack to them, really. So, you know, a lot of them want to come back. They won't admit it. They can't admit it, obviously, because they're on the huge contract. But with DeChambeau, you know, every statement he comes out with, he's saying, I've not made my mind up. And it's a challenge to LIV to get to the negotiation table, yeah, and pony up what he wants.
You mentioned egos there, and I think other sports might be looking at this, particularly something like tennis. The official world golf rankings have never been given to LIV players. How challenging has that been to the tour?
Well, it was what Greg Norman, who was the, you know, the original CEO of Liv, it was what he promised all the pros when they came on. So it's a real area of pride, and they'll get validation if and when they get it. You know, today could be a good day. We're expecting news from the official World Golf Ranking Board about whether they will actually give Liv, you know, a ranking status for this season. If they don't, it'll be a huge blow on the eve of the event in Riyadh that starts tomorrow. And if they do, you know, they'll really, really celebrate, because this is the win that they'd, you know, been chasing in what's been a torrid close season for them.
Yeah, OK. James Corrigan, really interesting. And yeah, we'll look forward to hearing more about that official World Golf Rankings Board announcement later, if that does happen today. Thank you very much for speaking to us. We also heard England's Justin Rose, after winning his 13th PGA Tour title at the weekend, saying his childhood self wouldn't feel very good about making that decision when he explained why he had not moved to the Live Tour. A couple of other headlines for you this morning. Joe Truman claimed gold in the men's 1 kilometre time trial at cycling's Track Elite European Championships in Turkey. The women's team pursuit took gold, setting a new world record time. And the British tennis number one, Emma Raducanu, won her first round match without a coach at the Transylvania Open in straight sets. She did part of her post-match interview in Romanian, which went down well with the crowd.
Cathy, thank you. Later today, crime understood through the psychology behind it.
Women rarely murder.
Award-winning drama inspired by real life.
And when they do, the victim is almost always someone close to them.
A forensic psychiatrist dealing with the impact of fatal violence.
I'm Dr. Alex Bridges. I help make sense of the senseless.
I just need to know if there was something I missed.
But when feelings are buried and a terrible truth is withheld, the darkness within can have a catastrophic impact.
The new series of This Thing of Darkness on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starting today at 2:15.
The weather today will be wet and breezy, spells of rain pushing northwards, and because it's cold in certain parts, it will fall as hill snow if you're in, well, certain areas of Wales and northern England.
Coming up after the news, we're at a school in Manchester as the House of Lords prepares to debate a phone ban. We'll be hearing from teachers, parents and pupils who say the government may need to go further and outlaw mobiles altogether.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster. It is 27 minutes to 8. Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
Scotland Yard is reviewing accusations that Lord Mandelson leaked sensitive government data to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein while he was a senior minister in Gordon Brown's cabinet. Downing Street said it stood ready to provide the police with whatever support was needed. Lord Mandelson has not responded to requests for comment on the allegations. The former Deputy Labour leader Baroness Harman told us Lord Mandelson had cast a stain over politics. She said he should be stopped from being a Privy Councillor. The former US President Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary have said they will testify before a congressional investigation into Epstein. The decision suspends a vote by lawmakers on whether to hold the couple in contempt for previously refusing to appear. A spokesperson for the Clintons said they looked forward to setting a precedent that applies to everyone. Sarah Ferguson's charity, Sarah's Trust, has announced it will close. A decision, it says, has been under discussion for some months. It follows emails included in the recent documents related to Jeffrey Epstein, suggesting the former Duchess of York was in contact with the convicted paedophile while he was in prison and visited him shortly after his release. BBC News has approached Sarah Ferguson for comment. Russian airstrikes hit Ukraine's capital Kyiv overnight, again targeting energy infrastructure during sub-zero temperatures. The city's mayor says more than 1,100 tower blocks have been left with hardly any heat. Elon Musk has announced the merger of his space and artificial intelligence companies SpaceX and XAI. The billionaire said the combined firm's initial focus would be to launch satellites which would work as AI data centers in space, where they could harness the sun's power without the expense of cooling. And peers in the House of Lords are to debate whether to introduce an outright ban on smartphones in schools. Government guidelines currently say schools should be mobile phone free environments, but some teachers have called for this to become law.
Thank you for that. It is 24 minutes to 8. What, if anything, then, are we going to do about phones in schools? The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, has written to head teachers saying that schools should be phone free environments by default. The Lords today is debating that statutory ban, which some schools say would make it easier and clearer to enforce. Our education correspondent Vanessa Clark has been visiting a school in Manchester which is calling for such a ban, to find out what a difference it would make.
A couple more minutes on this and then we will move on.
I'm here at Lostock High School in Manchester, and the classroom I've just been in is very quiet as students prepare for their mock exams. Most have a smartphone either on silent or switched off in their bag or pocket. The policy here is if it's seen or heard, it will be taken away. Assistant head teacher Samantha Zhang says the school is following government guidelines, but it's nearly impossible to be completely phone free.
We do find that, you know, we are catching students trying to use their phone in social times. If it became statutory that there were not allowed any mobile phones in school, that would help schools because we'd all be in the same boat. It would be fair. And then we'd more likely to get the buy-in from the parents and the families that we need.
Some schools are investing in lockable pouches that students keep on them or lockers they can put their phones in when they arrive. Here, they have looked into those options, but they are expensive.
So who here has a smartphone?
All of you.
Where is it at the moment?
In our pockets, yeah.
Students Abdullah, Amara, Bakhtir and Aman think the no see, no hear policy works well.
I would prefer to have my phone on me just in case that there might be an emergency, like at home. Like my parents might call me a lot, so I might have to check my phone.
A lot of the kids, they use their phone for their like bus travel or like their train ticket or anything, or to communicate with their parents.
The world's moving into a more modern society where we will require these type of phones.
Parents are arguing with their children daily.
Earlier this month, the House of Lords passed an amendment to the Children's Wellbeing and Schools Bill to include a ban on social media for under-16s. Later today, they will debate a ban on smartphones in schools. But Pepe Delasio from the Association of School and College Leaders says a total ban would bring challenges.
Many students need them for medical reasons, for travelling to and from school, and they are part of a daily life. So what we'd be asking for is a way in which that could be managed, investment to allow schools to control those situations in a safe and appropriate way.
Around 800 child protection professionals, including Kieran Murphy, the research lead for the Association of Child Protection Professionals, have signed an open letter to the Prime Minister calling for a smartphone ban in schools.
I don't think the no see, no hear policies are enough. That schools are put in the position of having to, you know, decide themselves that they are going to implement that and police that.
The Department for Education says all schools should be phone-free environments by default. It has started a three-month consultation into a social media ban for under-16s, which will also look at phones in schools.
And you feel confident with this topic?
Yeah, we're just doing revision.
So but back in Lostock High, another challenge is getting parents on board.
We do have parents who absolutely would like a ban. On the other hand, we have parents who say to us they do want their child to have their phone in school. At the moment, the distractions are too great and we will see a huge difference in their exam results potentially in the future. And we need to do what we can as a society to help our children to not be reliant on their mobile phone all day.
That was Vanessa Clark reporting. Let us talk to Baroness Spielman, Amanda Spielman, former head of Ofsted, who was listening to that and is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you say to a ban or no ban?
I think it's time for a ban. And I think increasing numbers of schools like the one you've just played see that. The out of sight and not in lessons policies, they just aren't effective. And children are sitting there right next to their phone, distracted and itching for the next opportunity to check. They're rushing off in breaks to find corners, to lock themselves in toilets, whatever, because they might have something from their friends. It really is disrupting schools. It's disrupting children's socialisation. It's disrupting their behaviour, and it is disrupting their learning. And as your other interviewees have said, parents are a bit split, and there are practicalities travelling to and from school that do, in practice, for most teenagers at least, need phones. And some pupils can be reluctant, though normally they like the change once it's happened. But essentially, heads and teachers need the reinforcement of a clear national policy, not just advice to schools. They need a clear national rule that they can tell parents absolutely does apply.
Why shouldn't that policy be lockers? Lockers that are paid for, because obviously some schools are pretty hard up, but lockers that are paid for centrally and where phones can be all day, so that you then get rid of that problem of parents saying, I need to know where my child is on the way to school and on the way home.
Yeah, lockers and the more recent innovation of the lockable pouches. are the two main innovations in schools that make it workable. But yes, it does cost, and it uses a bit of staff time to supervise and make sure that people are actually using the abuses that are possible. But once you get to the point, if you get to the point where it doesn't matter what school your child goes to, or if they have friends in their own school or other schools, if the child knows that they're not missing out, because the same rule applies to everybody, at that point you massively defuse the pressure of phones for all children and make it easier for schools to enforce. So that's why it goes beyond just something to support individual heads on. It's why there's real benefit in having a clear national policy. And this bill is an opportunity to get that onto the statute book, which is why the amendment's been proposed today.
Does this bill, though, and this amendment, mean no phones at all on the way to and from school, or does it provide for the lockers and the pouches?
It provides for the lockers and the pouches. Yeah. It prohibits use and possession of smartphones by pupils during the school day. So the various forms of handing in on arrival and collect on departure are absolutely compatible with this.
I understand why some schools might say this is difficult and expensive and all the rest of it. It does seem extraordinary, doesn't it, though, that in this country we can't simply come up with the money to pay for relatively small changes to the school day that could have an enormous impact.
Well, there are many arguments about school funding. There's no question it's under a lot of pressure at the moment. Sadly, it's a whole big subject, especially the funding of special educational needs that is overshadowing school budgets and making it hard to find everything else. But that's probably too big a conversation for this segment.
I suppose the issue, though, is whether there is a will, a political will and a social will, as it were, to do something that so many people think needs urgently to be done, and simply sort of holding up their hands and saying, well, it's quite expensive for schools. It just feels a bit pathetic, doesn't it? As if we've sort of lost control of something that we ought to be able to have control of.
It is weak, and I think around the world, increasingly, people are recognising the impact of these extraordinary addictive technologies on the young, and that children do need this time and space without smartphones in their hands or their pockets to grow up healthily, as well as to study without distractions. It is really important, and it should be a priority, and ministers do have the capacity to make this happen and to find the extra money, the little bit of extra money that schools would need to do it.
Amanda Spielman, Baroness Spielman, thank you very much.
It's 16 minutes to 8. NASA's wet dress rehearsal, as it's called, ahead of the launch of the Artemis 2 mission to loop astronauts around the moon, was stopped earlier with just 5 minutes to go until the simulated launch time. There is a huge amount of interest in this mission. It will retrace the steps of the original Apollo spacecraft. It will take humans on their first lunar journey in decades. But this is a setback, and it looks like the launch may now be delayed for some time. Rebecca Morell is our science editor. Rebecca, morning.
Good morning.
What exactly went wrong?
Well, the rehearsal is basically a test where they do everything they would do on launch day. The astronauts aren't involved, but everyone else is. And that includes fueling the rocket with 3 million litres of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. And they go all the way through the entire countdown sequence to T-minus 33 seconds, i.e. they're doing everything apart from put the rocket up into the air. The countdown stopped at 5 minutes before this sort of simulated launch time. And that was because of a hydrogen leak in a connector that goes from the launch tower to the rocket. And they did have some problems with hydrogen leaks a bit earlier in the launch sequence when they were trying to fill up the rocket. Now, hydrogen is notoriously leaky. It's a very small molecule. It has low mass, and it's kind of sneaky. It finds gaps that it can kind of get out of. And that's what happened here. They also had some problems closing the hatch to the capsule, the Orion capsule, which is where the astronauts are going to be strapped in. The astronauts weren't taking part, but a crew went in to actually try and close the hatch, and a pressure valve was inadvertently activated, and some audio problems as well with communications dropping out occasionally. So NASA have said, it's a test. It didn't go exactly as they wanted it. And the impact of that is the launch date is now going to be delayed to, the earliest will be March. So it was going to be going up as soon as the 9th of February, you know, just a few days away. So it's a little bit longer to wait before NASA try again. But they will be doing another dress rehearsal before they give the go ahead to launch.
Yeah, this is a real science editor question, I know. But when you look back to Apollo and how, you know, relatively primitive the technology was then, and we know so much more now, but it's still really tricky.
It's really, I mean, it is a mantra that everyone says space is hard, and it is. And they're being extra careful with this because, you know, there was an Artemis 1 mission which launched and sent the Orion capsule around the moon and back again, but no astronauts were on board, and that happened 3 years ago. It's the second time they've tried to launch this rocket. So they haven't had that many goes as actually getting it up in the air, and they want to be as careful as possible because, of course, this time you're going to have four astronauts strapped in to the top of that rocket. So yeah, they're taking every precaution. They really want to get these astronauts to the moon, but they have to do it safely. They can't take any risks, which is why they're being extra cautious. And the challenges that they've faced during this dress rehearsal, they do want to work through them. So yeah, I mean, it's not too much of a delay, hopefully, but yeah, we'll keep on tracking it.
Yeah, we will. All makes perfect sense. Thank you, Rebecca Morrell, the BBC science editor.
30 minutes to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning here in the studio is the Reverend Dr. Giles Fraser, the Vicar of St. Anne's Church, Kew. Good morning.
Morning, Justin. Last month, we had a break-in at my church. Windows were smashed in and the high altar candlesticks were stolen. There was blood everywhere as the person responsible cut himself on gaining entry. Finding real blood all over the cross was particularly disturbing. For several nights, I didn't sleep terribly well, tossing and turning, thinking about all those hymns that speak of Christ's blood being shed for me, but also of those two thieves who were crucified next to Jesus. I was furious at the violation of sacred space. Indeed, the candlesticks were given in memory of a lovely man whose funeral I'd taken a few years back. But as well as being angry, I couldn't help but wonder what place I could find in my heart for forgiveness. The person responsible was clearly in trouble. The church's CCTV showed him dipping his finger in the font as he was robbing the place. I didn't know what to think. Then I was reminded to go and look again at the story of Les Misérables, novel, film, play, one that celebrates 40 years in the West End this year. The convict, Jean Valjean, is found on the street by a local bishop who invites him into his house for dinner and rest. During the night, Valjean leaves the bishop's house and steals his tableware. Soon enough, the police catch up with him and they return him to the bishop. But instead of having the thief thrown into prison, the bishop tells the police that he'd actually given the tableware to Valjean, which he hadn't, and then reprimands Valjean for not having taken the candlesticks as well. The police can't work out what's going on. Valjean himself is deeply confused. The bishop gives him the candlesticks and Valjean goes on his way. This event turns out to be transformative in the life of Valjean, and throughout the story of Les Misérables, the bishop's candlesticks serve as this constant and powerful symbol of the new life that Valjean is now crafting for himself. It's just a novel, the hard-headed bit of me says. Justice requires consequences, and I get that. But I also have this quote from Hamlet that's constantly buzzing about in my head that says, roughly, if we all got what we deserved, who of us would escape a whipping? And then there is that blood on the cross, shed both for me and for all of us, miserables. That isn't justice, it's undeserved mercy, and I'm hugely grateful for it. A few days after the robbery, the thief handed himself into the police station and returned our stolen candlesticks. During the service of Candlemas on Sunday, I blessed them once again. They were back on the altar where they belong, having been on something of a journey, as indeed have I.
And that was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Dr. Giles Fraser. Brings us to 10 to 8.
A smaller than planned number of Palestinians managed to cross between Gaza and Egypt yesterday as the Rafah crossing reopened for the first time in nearly 2 years. That was a key part of the second phase of the Donald Trump brokered peace plan for Gaza, which has started but is moving very slowly at the moment. And even though the numbers of people who'll be allowed to arrive and leave each day was already small, only a handful made it through the security restrictions in the end. Well, we've been hearing from Nabal, who's 25 years old, lives in Jabalia, and is waiting to leave Gaza for medical care.
I was hit by a random artillery shell while I was holding my daughter. As a result, I lost both of my hands, my arms, below the elbow. I also suffered a severe injury to my left leg at risk of amputation. I had serious injuries to my abdomen, including my liver, as well as third and fourth degree burns. I cannot do simply daily tasks like feeding my daughter, hugging her, dressing her, or taking care of myself. Traveling for treatment is not just about healing my body. It's about restoring my dignity, my independence, and my connection with my daughter. I urgently need advanced prosthetic arms. Okay, I'm young, I mature, and I want to live. The war took away my freedom, my independence, and my sense of safety. I'm a victim of this war, left helpless and alone. Yet my situation continues to be ignored. Many people say that my condition is not life-threatening and describe it as a cosmetic. But this is far from the truth. I'm waiting for a phone call to confirm that I can't travel. I do not know when it will come. And this uncertainty is very hard. I hope to hug my daughter again, feed her, comb her hair, and do the simple things every mother should be able to do. I hope to rebuild my life and live with dignity again.
That is Nabal, like many thousands of others in Gaza, waiting to leave for medical care. Let's speak to Jeremy Bowen, our international editor. Jeremy, good morning. Where are we in terms of phase two and how it should be progressing?
Well, it's barely started, as you've been hearing. It's barely started because it started now essentially because Trump has said, yes, it's going to start. And the last of the bodies of the hostages came out. So Israel lifted its objections to reopening the Rafah crossing. However, as you've been hearing, very, very few people have got through on the first day. Maybe those are teething problems, but clearly there are issues about the restrictions on the movement. Humanitarian organizations, the UN, Tom Fletcher, the humanitarian chief, says they want to surge relief supplies through that crossing, and Israel at the moment is not allowing anything through it. So, you know, the short answer, this ceasefire is moving very, very slowly. A lot of Palestinians have been killed since it was signed back in October. 500, I think, more or less, including more than 100 kids. And life there has improved, NGOs say, and the UN says, in many ways, but it's still desperate by most people's standards.
And we've talked, Jeremy, before about the fact that President Trump will tend to focus on a particular issue until something else drags his attention away. And at the moment, that would seem to be Iran. It appears that we are going to get some negotiations between the US and the Iranian regime.
Yeah, when the ceasefire deal was done back in October, you know, a lot of people said its progress depends on Trump's focus. Well, what have we had since then? Venezuela, Greenland, now Iran. And yes, it looks as if there's going to be direct talks, reportedly in Istanbul, with the Turks and the Qataris being part of it as well, between Iran and the US. Steve Witkoff, the envoy, will be there. I mean, there is a feeling in the Middle East, in the region, among governments, that there are so many unknown unknowns about an attack on the clerical regime in Iran, that they are reluctant to see something like that happens. What do the Americans actually want to achieve? What can they achieve with airstrikes? So the Iranians, will they do some sort of a deal? Well, there are those who say, look, there's no point doing a deal with Iran because the regime will simply try to play for time. So will Trump want to go through with military action? These are loads of questions. I think he'll probably want a deal, but will he get the kind of deal that he wants? And Iran will say, okay, you want to do, we might do a deal, but we need sanctions relief in return for that. And that would, you could argue, strengthen a regime which has been killing its own people and which President Trump himself has said is illegitimate, and that he wants to help out those demonstrators.
Yeah, people may well wonder, Jeremy, because that was what he said at the start. And then it's sort of moved 180. Now he's talking about the nuclear deal, possibly ballistic missiles, who knows. But that it brings us back to that focus, doesn't it? People see things start to be about one topic and then move on to something else.
Well, this is the Trump style. There's a scattergun approach, which he's said to like because it keeps people off balance. They don't quite know where they're at, and then they are feeling vulnerable, and therefore they will make a deal. Maybe that will work in this case. We'll have to see. I think that it seems to me that what is missing here is actually a coherent strategy, thought out, worked out, about the way that America wants to proceed in terms of Iran, because there's a lot of loose talk about regime change, but the record, and you look at Iraq with Saddam Hussein, you look at Libya after the fall of Colonel Gaddafi, the record of regime change followed by chaos in the region is desperate. Iran is a really big and important country with nuclear facilities, more than 90 million people. Just saying there was suddenly a collapse of the government there, and I think it's highly unlikely that the regime would collapse, because even if it did, there are hard men there in the IRGC or in the military who would probably take over. But just saying that it did, what might happen there? What are the chances of some kind of chaos? And that, of course, is what its Arab neighbours in the region are very concerned about.
Yeah, Jeremy Bowen, our international editor. Thank you.
In 2019, we began investigating the disappearance of Dr. Ruja Ignatova.
I believe we are a very special network.
A scammer who stole billions from investors around the world.
Number one cryptocurrency globally.
She's on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And now we have some unmissable updates.
She has money, and when you have money, you have power.
Join me, Jamie Bartlett, as the hunt for the missing crypto queen continues. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Weather time now comes this morning from Simon King.
Justin, thanks so much indeed. Good morning. We've got some rain around at the moment across Wales, southwest and southeast England, up through the Midlands and towards eastern England. It's pretty cloudy, of course. Some hill fog as well. The rain is likely to turn a bit heavier and more widespread around southeast England into the Midlands during this afternoon. And by this evening, we'll start to get a bit of snow falling over the higher ground of North Wales. Temperatures about 3 to 7 degrees, but locally still up to about 11 degrees in southwest England. For northwest and northeast England, it's pretty overcast. We've got some rain over the Pennines. Otherwise, it's a largely dry start to the day. Not a great deal of change into the afternoon, but the possibility of a bit of hill snow over the Pennines later on, and highs of 3 or 4 degrees. Now, for Northern Ireland today, it's pretty cloudy and there will be some light and patch of rain moving its way in later this afternoon with temperatures of 4 to 6 Celsius. And for Scotland, well, for Northern and Eastern Scotland, we've had quite a bit of snow over higher ground. That's likely to continue giving some significant accumulations with some blizzards today. But down to low levels, it is just falling as rain. Temperatures, though, only about freezing. Western Scotland is where it's driest and brightest with top temperatures of 6 or 7 degrees Celsius.
Thank you, Simon. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster. Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 3rd of February. The headlines this morning: police are reviewing allegations that Lord Mandelson passed sensitive government information to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. We'll speak to a government minister after the news. Russia has carried out more heavy airstrikes on the Ukrainian capital Kyiv overnight, again targeting energy infrastructure at a time of freezing temperatures. And the planned launch of NASA's Artemis II moon rocket has been pushed back after a hydrogen leak was detected during tests.
And coming up in the next hour, what Anne Boleyn's fingers tell us about Elizabethan England and... As a major new exhibition opens, the historian Tom Holland will join us to explore the enduring allure of the samurai and why Britain is so captivated by Japan. The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
The government has said it'll provide whatever assistance is needed as the Metropolitan Police considers accusations that Lord Mandelson passed sensitive government information to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Scotland Yard said last night it was reviewing allegations of misconduct in public office. Documents released by the US authorities appear to show Epstein was sent details of internal discussions from the heart of the UK government. Our political correspondent Nick Eardley reports.
The latest files released by the US Department of Justice provide evidence of just how close the relationship between Lord Mandelson and Jeffrey Epstein was. When he was business secretary, Lord Mandelson appeared to share a message written by an aide to the then Prime Minister Gordon Brown discussing the possible sale of government assets. He also appeared to confirm plans for a 500 billion euro bailout by Eurozone countries. After calls for police to investigate, the Metropolitan Police said last night that it was reviewing reports of alleged misconduct to determine if they met the criminal threshold for investigation. Lord Mandelson has not responded to requests for comment about the allegations. The government said it would provide whatever support and assistance the police needed. Lord Mandelson also continues to face pressure to step down from the House of Lords, with the government saying he should no longer be a member of the chamber.
The former US President Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary have agreed to testify in the congressional investigation into Jeffrey Epstein. The couple had faced the possibility of being held in criminal contempt of Congress after refusing requests to appear in person before lawmakers. A spokesman said they looked forward to setting a precedent that applies to everyone. Last night, Sarah Ferguson's charity Sarah's Trust announced it was closing for the foreseeable future after new revelations emerged about the former Duchess of York's friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. Emails from the latest release of documents suggest she was in contact with Epstein while he was in prison and had asked for his advice about her business, The Mother's Army. Chichi Izundu reports.
Jeffrey Epstein was released from prison on July 22, 2009, after serving 13 months. But an email from a Sarah in June 2009 says, "I need to ask you how to start the Mother's Army company so it can be commercial. How do I do that? Can you help me?" Mother's Army is registered at Royal Lodge to Sarah Ferguson in Company's House. Documents appear to show that the day after Epstein was released from prison, his assistant arranged British Airways flights from London to Miami for Sarah Ferguson and some of her staff. Epstein paid more than £10,000 for them. The trip was to visit Epstein in his Palm Beach mansion 5 days after he'd been released from jail and was under house arrest. The email between Epstein and the Sarah confirms it will be myself, Beatrice and Eugenie attending. Epstein offered them a menu of vegetable lasagna for lunch, and she responds she cannot wait to see him. There are other emails suggesting at least 3 meetings between the pair in 2009. BBC News has approached Sarah Ferguson's representatives and is yet to hear back.
Russia has attacked the Ukrainian capital Kyiv and the eastern city of Kharkiv with missiles and drones overnight, again targeting energy infrastructure. President Zelensky said more than 70 missiles were launched at his country, as well as 450 attack drones. 9 people are reported to have been injured. Sarah Rainsford reports from Kyiv.
We heard the first explosions here in Kyiv soon after midnight, and the air raid lasted for over 7 hours as Russia launched ballistic missiles and drones across Ukraine in waves. Once again, the energy infrastructure was targeted just as the temperature dropped below minus 20 degrees. This morning, Kyiv's mayor said 2 regions of the capital, that's more than 1,100 tower blocks, have been left with barely any heating again. The private energy company DTEC has confirmed that its own thermal power plants were hit. That's the 9th large-scale attack on the power grid since October. Last week, Donald Trump claimed Vladimir Putin had agreed to pause these strikes because of the extreme cold. Mr. Trump called that a very nice act. But Russia has always left a gap between its massive attacks, and if there ever was an energy truce, then it is definitely over. Last night, many Ukrainians slept in metro stations for shelter, some pitching tents on the platforms for extra warmth. All of this as Ukraine and Russia are due to hold more peace talks this week. Moscow is piling on the pressure in advance.
A senior EU commissioner has said Brussels would be open-minded about discussing closer trade ties with the UK, including the possibility of working together on a customs union. Valdis Dombrovskis, the EU economy commissioner, also said talks on a UK-EU youth mobility scheme were very advanced. Mr. Dombrovskis met the Chancellor Rachel Reeves yesterday and afterwards spoke to our economics editor Faisal Islam.
Mr. Dombrovskis indicated that a deal on a UK-EU youth mobility scheme was set to be signed within months. He also welcomed the renewed possibility of the UK joining a key EU defence industrialisation fund called SAFE.
We're open for further discussions, and we know that Prime Minister Starmer has expressed interest actually to come back to this issue, and there's certainly openness from EU side for this. Well, the world has definitely changed, and that certainly requires a cooperation of like-minded partners like EU and UK.
The Chancellor yesterday hosted what was described as one of the most cooperative UK-EU meetings since Brexit. The new grouping, dubbed the Quint, included three UK cabinet ministers and two commissioners, including Mr. Dombrovskis. They could now meet more regularly. The Chancellor said the UK and EU speaking with one voice was now necessary on issues such as the economy, trade and security, as she said the world was moving to a place where the rules were less clear. I also asked Mr. Dombrovskis about the UK debate on rejoining the customs union. He said the EU was ready to engage with an open mind and to seek areas of cooperation.
Ministers have published the first ever national plan to tackle the harmful so-called forever chemicals found in the environment. They're known as PFAS and are used in many everyday products. The proposals include a ramping up of water testing. Children and young people with cancer in England are to have the cost of their travel for treatment paid for through a new government scheme. Ministers say the £10 million fund will support families who often face long and frequent journeys to specialist centres. Our health correspondent Sophie Hutchinson reports.
Almost 2,000 children and young people diagnosed each year with cancer in England need to travel to specialist centres for treatment. This often results in them making multiple long journeys, which the charity Young Lives Against Cancer estimated could cost on average £250 a month. Some families can claim back their travel expenses under a means-tested scheme, but many can't. Some say they've taken out loans, cut back on food, and fallen behind with their bills. The new government scheme will cover the travel costs of all young people up to the age of 24 by 2027.
A dress rehearsal for the Artemis II rocket launch has been stopped early by NASA. The US space agency halted the countdown at the launch pad in Florida because of a hydrogen leak. It was a critical test for the mission, which will see astronauts travel around the moon and back for the first time in more than 50 years. Our science editor Rebecca Morell reports.
During a dress rehearsal, NASA run through everything they would do on launch day, including fueling the rockets with 3 million litres of liquid hydrogen and oxygen and taking the countdown to just before blastoff at T-minus 33 seconds. But NASA stopped the test 5 minutes early because of a hydrogen leak from an umbilical connection that links the launch tower to the rocket. They also had problems earlier in the launch sequence closing a hatch to the Orion capsule where the four astronauts going to the moon will be strapped in, and some issues with audio communication channels. NASA said they would now need to conduct a second dress rehearsal, and the earliest the rocket could launch is March.
Doctor Who fans can bid for a piece of television history in an online auction of props from the BBC sci-fi series, which opens today. More than 300 lots are up for grabs, including costumes, three sonic screwdrivers and a Dalek. Sean Taylor, a project manager at the Auction House prop store, described one of the standout items.
We have our TARDIS, which is the cherry on the top of the auction. This is from the Jodie Whittaker episode, Eve of the Daleks. What they've done with this one is they put these incredible cracks throughout the whole surface of it. And when lit from inside, it gives this kind of eerie red glow, which is absolutely wonderful. And of course, if you've got the space, it is absolutely iconic.
That was Sean Taylor from the Doctor Who auction.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. What should happen next in the emerging scandal surrounding Peter Mandelson, who is, of course, still Lord Mandelson? He is accused not just of being a good friend of the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, but now of much more, of leaking to him at the height of the financial crisis when he was business secretary, documents that could have allowed Epstein to trade on secret information. Reform and the SNP have called for a police investigation. The police say they are looking into the matter. The former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has revealed as well that he asked the Cabinet Secretary to investigate leaks during his time in office back in September last year, but was told at that time there was no evidence to be looked at. We will hear in a moment from a government minister, but first First, let us talk to Sir Ed Davey, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, who is here in the studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
What should happen now?
Well, I certainly support a police investigation. It looks like crime has been committed, misconduct in public office, which is very serious. It impacts everyone's lives if someone at the very top of government is betraying our country. So very serious, definitely a police investigation. Clearly, Lord Manson should be stripped of his peerage. But I think we need to think even more deeply about this. I think the case for a public inquiry into national security and indeed the British victims of Epstein has now become absolutely a requirement. This is so serious in the impact it has on how we govern ourselves, as of course, as well as the victims, that I think the case for a public inquiry is now overwhelming.
Danger, though, with the public inquiry, it's just a lot of waffle and it takes years and we never learn that much anyway, or that much we didn't know.
Well, the police investigation should come first. If there's a crime committed, that obviously takes a precedent. And, of course, he should be taken out of the House of Lords.
Well, let me
the long-term policy implications of this, Justin, are so serious.
Okay,
I think it merits an inquiry.
And people will hear that. On the Lords, should he be not only taken out of the Lords, and he may well not go back to the Lords himself, but what really upsets people is the fact, and it's not just him, actually, there are other peers, some of whom have been to prison and still call themselves Lord, whatever, then actually there ought to be a way simply of stopping that. And would you, if the government came forward with a bill to say that should not happen anymore, if you have committed a serious offence, you'd find a threshold somewhere, you should not be able to call yourselves Lord whatever.
I completely agree with that.
And you would support it then if the government did that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think first of all, we should strip Lord Mandelson of his peerage. We can do that today. It's a very short bill just to focus on Lord Mandelson. But the point you make is there needs to be deeper reform. Liberal Democrats have long argued for very significant reform of the House of Lords. This particular one is now in the public domain. And I think the public demands that people who are in Parliament, if they have broken the law, in very grave ways, that they shouldn't be allowed to call themselves a Lord. They shouldn't sit in Parliament. And I think the House of Lords needs to get behind reform. I think it would get cross-party agreement. I think it could be done relatively quickly.
Right, and that's the other point, because what the government seems to be suggesting is we don't want to waste time and, in effect, do things that the public, or not do other things that the public want us to do. But you're saying, actually, it could get very quick support and go through, yeah, what, in a day or two?
If it's focused on Lord Mandelson in a day or two, I think that a longer-term reform may take a little bit longer. They would need to make sure we've got all the details sorted out. We want to get it right. And we know that emergency legislation has a pretty bad record, so let's get it right. But it could be done relatively quickly. And here's the other point. The public don't trust our political system in the way that they used to. The need to rebuild the trust in our system is so important. Democracy is under threat by some people in our country. It's under threat around the world. We have to make sure that people see that democracy works for them and that they can trust it.
What about
this is
the judgment?
One of the many things we need to do for that.
What about the judgment of appointing Peter Mandelson as US ambassador? Which wasn't that long ago, was it? I'm just looking at what the Foreign Secretary, Secretary David Lammy said at the time. Wonderful to welcome Peter back to the team. He offers a wealth of experience in trade, economic and foreign policy from his years in government and the private sector.
Well, many of us wondered about the appointment at the time. And I think the Prime Minister does have to be held to account for that decision. We don't know what he knew, but those people in Whitehall who are supposed to brief the Prime Minister on such an important appointment, what did they know? What did they put in front of the Prime Minister? It may well be that Lord Mandelson lied to the Prime Minister, but there was so much already in the public.
Well, exactly. I mean, they knew that he knew Jeffrey Epstein.
Yes, indeed. And given Gordon Brown was so worried that he thought there should be an inquiry and sought about inquiry quite a few months ago, what did Gordon Brown know earlier that was well known in Whitehall? So there's no doubt that the decision by the Prime Minister to appoint Lord Mandelson to that post should be questioned.
Okay, Sir Ed Davey, thank you very much for talking to us. Listening to that, Karen Smith, who is the Minister for Health and Social Care and is in our Millbank studio. Good morning to you.
Morning, Justin.
Does the government support now a criminal case being brought against Peter Mandelson?
Well, absolutely support the police if there is such a thing. It's criminality to do that work, of course.
And when it comes to his peerage, do you accept that it would be relatively easy, actually, to strip him of his peerage and that that should happen?
Well, I mean, I heard Ed Davey there, and I agree with Ed that it is shocking. It is reputational on politics more widely in the House of Lords. And we have approached all parties to look at what should be done more widely on this issue.
So, right, if you can come to an agreement with the other parties, well, it will happen.
It's good to hear from Ed Davey, as leader of the Liberal Democrats, that he would want to work with that. But as he said, in one breath, it could be done in a day, and then it might take longer. So it'd be important to get this right. It isn't just about Peter Mandelson. The right thing here is for Peter Mandelson to withdraw from the House of Lords in light of these recent really shocking revelations of emails.
Yes,
but working with other parties in the Lords to get this right is absolutely what we'd like to try and do.
But is the end place that you think is the right place to be, that someone who has certainly committed crimes, as quite a few members of the House of Lords have, and we don't yet know whether Peter Mandelson has or not, and I think if he were here he would say he hasn't, let's make that clear, but if someone has committed a crime in the Lords, that they are no longer able to call themselves Lord in ordinary life, is that the end place that we should get to?
Well, I mean, I would agree. I think people think it's shocking that that isn't the case. So we are in very new territory here, which is why looking at this issue of Lords, either in criminal activities or other disreputable activities that bring the place into disrepute, is looked at more widely. That is why it would be more complicated legislation, I would suggest, you know, being a legislator. That's the sort of thing that would start to come into this. So I think very rapidly we'd want to get discussion from the other parties across Parliament and in the Lords. Obviously, we have a majority in the Commons, so that is more straightforward for that support, but to work with the Lords to make sure that we got this right, and we looked at that more broadly. As you are rightly bringing up other issues, other cases, this is unprecedented. It's not, you know, it hasn't been done before, despite other cases being brought forward. So we are in very new territory, but the Prime Minister is very clear by approaching those parties yesterday that we want to look at this very quickly.
What future does Peter Mandelson have as an advisor to Labour?
None.
Does he, do you think, realise that? Because he's given an interview to the Times, albeit before the very latest revelations, in which he seems to suggest that he might have that future. Do you accept that one of the reasons he might think he has it is the way he's been treated by not just this Labour Prime Minister, but previous ones as well?
I'd seen that article this morning before doing these interviews. Mm. And I think, like, sadly, many other men I've seen in similar positions over the years, there is a lack of real reality and understanding about the depth of this now demonstrated in that interview. I'm not entirely sure what day that interview took place, but each hour is bringing really shocking and quite astonishing levels of email correspondence. I think that is shocking absolutely everybody. So I think the realisation has to dawn on him about what that means.
When you say men in these positions, I mean, it's an interesting point, isn't it, that he's then appointed and reappointed by men, even when it's perfectly well known that he had a friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. He didn't deny it. He was sorry for it, he said, but he didn't deny it. Do you think there is something to be said to the various men who brought him back into government?
I mean, I think what I mean by that, in these cases, it is overwhelmingly men that are involved in these sorts of episodes and continue to look to the media to sort of share their soul, if you like, without really realising, particularly the impact and the re-traumatising of the women that are at the heart, that have started off this look into Jeffrey Epstein, and really through their bravery. That's why we know about this.
But that's,
and I think we shouldn't forget
that. But that's the point, isn't it? So in 2024 it was, wasn't it? The end of 2024, when he's appointed ambassador to Washington, the various people appointing him would have known that he had that friendship and thought, well, it doesn't matter, essentially. I just quoted the Foreign Secretary then at the time, David Lammy, saying it's wonderful to welcome him back to the team. I mean, they knew that he'd been pally with Epstein.
But as we know now, a lot of people were friends with Jeffrey Epstein. But I don't think anybody, well, apart from those people involved, obviously, they obviously did know and did not reveal. But the wider public had no idea of the scale of this and the depth of this and what it involved. And Peter Mandelson at that time was a public figure involved in all aspects of public life. So these are new, and I think we do need to look at that in that light. They are shocking, they are astonishing, they're appalling, but the depth of what we're seeing unveiled every hour in this latest so-called dump of evidence is of a different scale to what anyone thought was happening, and takes us into different directions as well, beyond the initial friendship.
Exactly. And talking of one of those directions, we've got Gordon Brown now wanting an inquiry, a wider inquiry into what went on during his prime ministership and the leaking of things that he's already complained about or wanted an inquiry into back in last September. What should happen about that now?
Well, again, the Prime Minister has asked the Cabinet Secretary to look at those emails, particularly from that period of government. That's the right thing to do. As I understand it, Gordon Brown said he asked for some of that to be done previously, but that didn't reveal these emails. The world was different in 2009 than it is now in government. I guess one should never say never, but it's not possible to be sending emails from a ministerial email address that would not be known by the department.
Sure, but
and that's not the case then, and it is really shocking.
Gordon Brown was concerned about this and knew enough that worried him back in September. It's odd, isn't it, that the Prime Minister, the number 10 machinery, didn't act then, just told him, look, there's no evidence. Sorry, that's it.
Well, that is why the Cabinet Secretary needs to look into that, as to why that was not clear, or indeed why, and as we have said, Peter Mandelson obviously did not reveal the truth in that case to the Prime Minister at that period of time either. So that's why the Cabinet Secretary does need to look at that period of time in government as well.
But he specifically, what Gordon Brown says, he asked the Cabinet Secretary to look at communications about the banking collapse, the sale of assets, etc., between Lord Mandelson and Mr. Epstein. That's what Gordon Brown asked them to look at, and they said there's no evidence and just didn't go any further. That feels as if they weren't very curious, doesn't it? And at a political level, the Prime Minister as well wasn't as curious as perhaps he should have been.
Well, I don't think we know that, Justin, because if we don't know whether there was not a depth of investigation at that stage, which the Cabinet Secretary looked at, or they didn't have access to or didn't see those emails. I don't know. You don't know. That's why the Cabinet Secretary needs to look exactly what was revealed. That's why I say today, any email I sent is held by the Department of Health and Social Care. That wouldn't happen. I don't know if that was the case back in 2009. And that's exactly the level of that probing, or indeed whether they had that information, is exactly what the Cabinet Secretary needs to come back with to the Prime Minister with very quickly.
Just a final thought. If the Congressional Committee do say that they want to talk to Peter Mandelson, as they have said they want to talk to former Prince Andrew, should he testify?
Yes.
Karen Smith, Minister for Health and Social Care. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's 24 minutes past eight. Let's talk about something a little different. A new exhibition about some of the most feared warriors in history, the samurai, is opening at the British Museum today. The Japanese fighters and their extraordinary story have piqued our interest for years, haven't they? Not least the incredible armour and swords are always just fascinating to look at. Tom Holland is with us, the historian, the host of the Rest is History podcast. Morning, Tom.
Morning.
I don't want to reduce it just to what they wore. But we do
so
love that kind
wear
of thing.
Is amazing.
Well, exactly, and I think that's one of the things that really draws people in.
Yes, so they have stunning collections. You walk into the exhibition, and there is a kind of glimmering, menacing, exquisitely beautiful, exquisitely threatening set of armour. And then right at the end, you come up with the robes and helmet worn by Darth Vader in The Empire Strikes Back. And I think that what that brilliantly conveys is a sense of how potent the myth of the samurai has been, not just in Japan, but across the world. It's a global brand.
Yeah. And you know, what they did as well, the story itself, the kind of people they were, is equally as interesting.
Well, I think what is fascinating is that, in a sense, the history of the samurai comes in two parts. So the first part, they are the great warriors that kind of shadow our imaginings. And these are the figures with their swords, and they're fighting off the Mongols, and they're fighting one another. And then that you have this great samurai chief who becomes the shogun. So as in the drama series that was on, what was it, Amazon, I think, recently. And he establishes a kind of universal peace. And the samurai are enshrined as a kind of a military caste, but they don't really have any fighting to do. So the second half of the exhibition shows all the things they're getting up to, which includes not just kind of keep wearing this spectacular armor, but also commissioning exquisite art, doing the tea ceremonies, all this kind of stuff, marching to and from the great city that will become Tokyo. And so it's an exhibition that is about how the kind of the killer instinct the samurai had, but also this incredible aesthetic instinct. And I think it's that fusion of menace and beauty that makes them such a compelling subject and makes the British Museum show just stunning.
Yeah.
I mean, a stunning show.
I didn't realise for a long time as well, and it feels like a very modern thing, that they were so good at creating myths and legends about themselves.
Well, I think it's happening right from the very beginning. So initially, the Japanese court around the year 1000 is incredibly civilian. And the kind of the courtiers who live there view the soldiers, the samurai. Samurai just means retainers. I mean, kind of servants almost, out in the provinces as thuggish barbarians. And so when the samurai start taking over this civilian infrastructure, as of course they were bound to do because they're the ones with the swords, they want to get rid of this idea of themselves as savages and brand themselves as being, if not the peers, and at least kind of, you know, comparable to the silken courtiers in Kyoto. And so the process of myth-making is there right from the beginning. You can't really distinguish the myth from the history. They're completely interfused.
Mm. It's interesting as well, as you say, you know, the way that we're just drawn in by the glamour of it all, and it's a very international thing. I went to a couple of years ago to the Samurai Museum in Kyoto, and it was really notable how many different people, all ages, all different countries represented and really drawn in by what they were seeing. Even the armour that you could try on, which I think was supposed to be for the kids. The adults were piling right in, getting the helmets on, getting the armour on. You know, it doesn't matter where you are, it transcends.
I know, it's such a shame it's just confined to the children. I mean, who wouldn't like to put on some samurai armour? And I guess in the kind of the, you know, the 20th century, 21st century, the great parallel with the samurai would be the American cowboy. They're both kind of, you know, kind of based, rooted in fact, but also fictional. And it's telling that so many samurai films inspired Westerns. So I guess the Seven Samurai inspiring the Magnificent Seven is the famous one, but also samurai films are the great inspiration for the spaghetti Westerns. So A Few Dollars More and all of that.
Yeah. Tom, it's
and
always...
of course,
oh, yeah.
It's the inspiration for Star Wars.
Well, of course, exactly. I know. It runs through everything. Tom, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you so much. Tom Holland, historian, the host of the Rest is History podcast.
Just a word to say, Amol is going to take on a question that's been rumbling through the programme for weeks. Is social media now a threat to humanity, from our children's safety to our attention spans to our mental health? What is this technology really doing to us? If indeed it is doing anything at all, is it just one more scare, like so many scares we've had in the past, as indeed we were once frightened of radio? Anyway, Amol will doubtless bring that up in the Today debate. It's straight out of the 8 o'clock news here on Radio 4. You can listen anytime on BBC Sounds. I assume not anytime now, because it hasn't happened yet.
Yes,
although BBC
anytime.
Sounds is an extraordinary place, so possibly you can.
Carthy, we can hear you. Hello.
Hello. Giggling. I'm just still slightly scared of radio is what I was thinking. Yeah. Right, football headlines to start. Sunderland beat Burnley 3-0 to move up to eighth place in the Premier League table. Sunderland are on a run of 12 games without a home defeat. The Premier League had its quietest ever winter transfer deadline day, with just 7 deals completed yesterday, the biggest of which was Crystal Palace signing striker Jorgen Strand Larsen from Wolves in a club record 4-year deal worth up to £48 million. Now it is Arsenal versus Chelsea in the second leg of the semi-finals of the League Cup this evening, and the former Arsenal, West Ham and England footballer. Matt Upson joins us. Morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Hello. Arsenal won the first leg 3-2, and there aren't many two-leg fixtures anymore. They now have home advantage. They are in four competitions, Arsenal, so this may not be a priority, but how much would getting into a final just be a boost in the second half of the season to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first leg showed that it is relatively a priority for Mikel Arteta. Okay, it might not be, shall we say, the most important competition they're in the season, but it's an opportunity to get the first trophy under their belt. And from Arsenal's perspective and what they're trying to achieve, that would give a real belief and confidence to the team and the squad. So I think after the first leg and looking at their position now going into the second, this is going to be a big game for Arsenal.
Yeah, and the manager, Mikel Arteta, used the day-by-day cliche when he was asked about the possibility of winning the Premier League, FA Cup and League Cup. They're also still in the Champions League as well. Do you think, though, there might be some internal conversations about really trying to make this an historic season, not just with the Premier League, but with cup competitions as well?
Yeah, I think that's quite dangerous in some ways because, I mean, just for Arsenal's point of view, the psychology in them seeing it over the line and winning the Premier League is a big enough challenge in one season by itself. So I don't think there's any mistake that is their goal. That's what the club needs. That's what the manager wants. It's what the players want. They want that Premier League title. So everything else can be a little bit of a distraction. But I think after the weekend's results, how that's looking, Arsenal in a really strong position. The squad is pretty healthy and there's a few injuries and people out. But on the whole, they've got the depth. I think it frees them up maybe to go a little bit bigger in this game and see this second leg semi-final as an opportunity to really seal this victory and get themselves into a final.
And there's another major test now for the new head coach, not that new, I suppose, a month in, Leon Rossignol at Chelsea. How do you feel he started his tenure? It's going quite well.
It can't have been much better, really, can it? I mean, the results have been superb. Even the first leg at Stamford Bridge where Arsenal could have crept ahead to 4-1 at one point. You thought it was really going to swing in Arsenal's favour. They came back, big comeback again against West Ham on Saturday, which while, you know, there's questions about certain elements of the performance, it's built a feel-good factor and a buzz. And, you come back from 2-0 down to win 3-2 in front of your home fans, they get on board. So it's building a little bit of momentum and that energy that Chelsea needs. So, I mean, he's had a fantastic start to his life at Chelsea.
Well, look forward to the commentary with Matt Upson and the team on Five later. Have a good evening with that, Matt. A couple of other headlines for you from the Six Nations. England will start their campaign without their captain, Mario Tojo, on the pitch. The captain will be on the bench for England's opening game against Wales after missing their pre-tournament camp to go to his mother's funeral. And Ireland are just announcing their team at the moment for their match against France on Thursday. Jeremy Lookman is starting. James Lowe is out, replaced by Jacob Stockdale. There will be details of that after the full announcement on the BBC Sport website. And just to finish, the British tennis number one, Emma Raducanu, won her first round match without a coach at the Transylvania Open in straight sets. And she did part of her post-match interview in Romanian. Bit of a crowd pleaser being able to speak Romanian in Transylvania.
Which is a family link, yes?
Her father is Romanian, so she speaks Romanian and Mandarin, which her mother is Chinese.
Which is really quite impressive.
That's quite impressive.
It's along with all the tennis training as well. Thank you, Carthy. Now, next week here on Radio 4, Johnny Diamond has a new series.
The history of the Middle East is a complicated and contested one that often leads us to ask, how did we get here? I'm Johnny Diamond, and in this new series, with the help of some expert guests, I'm going to go back to biblical times and work through to the present day in an attempt to answer that question. We'll talk about some of the key people and events that have shaped the region over the centuries. That's How Did We Get Here? Israel and the Palestinians, with me, Johnny Diamond. Starting next Monday evening at 8 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
To the weather. It's going to be wet and breezy today. Spells of rain pushing northwards. It'll fall as hell snow for parts of Wales and northern England.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster. It is 25 to 9. Let's get a summary of the news with Alan Smith.
The leader of the Liberal Democrats, Ed Davey, has told us he believes Lord Mandelson could be stripped of his peerage in a day or two. But the Health Minister, Karen Smith, said she believed it would take longer. The Metropolitan Police has said it's reviewing allegations that Lord Mandelson leaked government data to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Lord Mandelson has not responded to requests for comment. Bill and Hillary Clinton have agreed to testify in a congressional investigation about Epstein. They made the announcement days before a vote on whether to hold them in criminal contempt for refusing previously to appear. Ukraine says Russia launched more than 70 missiles at the country overnight, again targeting energy infrastructure during freezing conditions. At least 9 people have been injured. And NASA has stopped final testing for the Artemis II rocket launch after a hydrogen leak was found. The launch date has now been delayed for the mission, which will see a crew fly around the moon for the first time in more than 50 years.
Alan, thank you very much. Now, the parents of a teenage boy who was stabbed to death at school by a fellow pupil say he could have been saved if teachers had taken action over previous bad behaviour by his killer. Harvey Wilgoose was attacked by Muhammad Umar Khan, who was able to take a hunting knife into All Saints Catholic High School in Sheffield without checks and had a history of carrying weapons in his bag. A private review was commissioned by St Clair Catholic Multi-Academy Trust, which runs the school. The trust said that it wouldn't be publishing the report because of the sensitivities involved, but it has released the recommendations. Well, Caroline Wilgoose is Harvey's mum, and she's been telling me what she learned from the review into Harvey's death.
We found out so many things, so many red flags, more than we thought. And one of them, which stands out, is 130 incidences at his previous school was reported with violence, gangs, knives and anger.
And for you to find this out, as you did in a report, knowing that there were, as you described them, red flags, things that could have been acted on. And the point is they weren't, were they?
No. No, it's heartbreaking because I feel like both of the boys have been failed, not just Harvey, but the other boy as well. He even asked for help, really. He told the teacher in All Saints that he got anger problems and he can't deal with his emotions.
And part of the problem is, and I think one of the reasons why it's so brave and important, actually, Caroline, that you're doing this and you're talking about it, is that these things are so often, they're kept quiet, information isn't shared, they're not talked about openly, and that can be one of the issues here.
I think the problem is because the academies are a brand, it's all about the reputation of the school. They don't want to tarnish the reputation, so they don't put it out there. And they sweep it under carpet, really, basically, and that's what this is.
What have the school said to you since?
Nothing.
Nothing at all.
No.
Even in light of these failings that have been identified.
No, they've not said anything to us, because I think they don't want to look like they've done anything wrong.
What do you want them to do?
I want them to publish it. I want them to apologise to all those children that was there at the time, that are being cancelled, that are never going to get over this. I want an apology from them, and I want to see step by step things put in place so this does not happen again.
Are you confident that things are changing as a result of this? As you say, we haven't seen the full report. That hasn't been published. But do you feel that some of these issues are being acted upon?
I think people are starting to listen to us now. I think it's talked about more. And I do think it's slowly. I do think things are changing. I'm hoping that this is going to boost my campaign for knife archers. I want parents to get behind me and get things put in place and go into schools and educate children of the devastation of knife crime on both sides. Like I always said, there's no winners here.
And the thing about knife archers that you want, because in this case, obviously this boy was able to bring a knife fully into school and not be checked. That was one of the things that happened and one of the reasons he was able to stab Harvey that day.
The teacher, as he entered school that day, said, "Have you got anything on you?" And he said, "No. If you've got a reason to ask, you've got a reason to search."
And obviously a knife arch would have shown that up straight away.
Yeah, yeah.
The school have said that the report identifies areas for improvement. They say we've already implemented a number of robust measures over the last year. We'll continue to take action in line with the report's recommendations and external advice from the statutory safeguarding agencies. But you want this not just to be about the one school And that's why we're having this conversation. You want this to be something that schools everywhere are thinking more carefully and closely about.
Things have got to be learnt from this. The axe was reported in October and nothing was done. If they'd have looked into the history of Umar, they would have realised that he'd got an unhealthy interest in weapons and things could have been done.
Do you feel like people are listening to you? Do you think that things will change?
Yeah, I think things are changing. I think people are listening. I think parents are getting behind me now and realising that there is a problem with knives in schools. Whereas even a year ago when Arva said to me, there's a knife, they carry knives, I'm not going to school because they carry knives. And I was give over Arva, as if anybody's going to take a knife into school. You think of it being gang culture and we know now and we're learning now that it's not.
And obviously it was conversations like that. And the fact that he's not with you today, a year on, that obviously makes you feel so strongly about this whole campaign.
Yeah, I mean, I found out through the report that he even messaged the school and said, I'm not coming into school while there's knives in that school. I didn't know this until this report.
And how are you and the family coping, Caroline? Because I know we've talked about all of the important things, the things that you want to change, the fact that you don't want this to happen to anybody else, and that purpose and bravery is so important. But for you, every day you're living without him.
It's absolutely horrendous. Last night were horrendous. Today we're going to go to mass at 10 o'clock. But it's heartbreaking. We miss him. And I still feel like I'm going to wake up from this nightmare.
Caroline, I'm sure we'll all be thinking about you today. It's such a difficult day. And I appreciate you doing this today and having the strength and the courage to have this conversation. We wish you well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
18 minutes to nine is the time. The latest release of files relating to Jeffrey Epstein has brought more unwanted attention, of course, for some high-profile people both here and in the US, and we've talked a lot about Peter Mandelson and Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. But we wanted to listen as well to the women who were victims of Epstein's abuse. Lisa Phillips hosts a podcast called From Now On, which examines the complex dynamics of abuse. She told the BBC World Service she was a victim of Epstein's abuse after meeting the billionaire while visiting his private Caribbean island.
During dinner is when I met Jeffrey Epstein, and he walked right up to me and said hello and sat down next to me. And since he already knew the other girls, he spent a lot of time talking to me. I told him my first few years I lived in Oxford, England. And so he was like all excited about that, you know, because, you know, Ghislaine is from there and a lot of people he knows are from Oxford. And so he found that really interesting. And he was like, oh, you're kind of English. Do you want to meet a prince? And I was just like, okay, sure, whatever. And at that time, he was one of the princes of England. And then later on that night, one of the younger girls said that, you know, Jeffrey was ready for his massage. And I'm like, I don't know how to do a massage. Like, this isn't something I know how to do, you know? And so she said, you have to. And so I went with her into Jeffrey's, it was his bedroom on the other side of the island. And Jeffrey had done a good job of, you know, getting to know me and making me feel comfortable. So I didn't really feel like it was weird at first. I just thought, okay, I just, you know, trapped on this island, so this is something I'm going to have to do, and just thought I would just, like, do it and leave. but Jeffrey had assaulted me during that massage and with the other girl. And so it didn't turn out to be just a massage.
She mentioned a prince there, the former Prince Andrew, now known as Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, has, of course, always strongly denied any wrongdoing. Meanwhile, Bill and Hillary Clinton are to answer questions in the House of Representatives committee looking into the Jeffrey Epstein affair. Initially, of course, they'd said no. Now, though, it seems they've changed their minds. They say they are setting a precedent that others should follow. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, has been telling me what's actually going to happen.
Both Clintons have agreed to appear in front of the House of Representatives Oversight Committee and talk to them about any information they have about Jeffrey Epstein. Members of the committee are convinced that people like Bill Clinton, who spent time with Jeffrey Epstein, might have valuable information about the people he associated with, his lifestyle, things that could help them with an investigation into what other men, what friends and associates of Jeffrey Epstein may also have been involved in abusing his victims. Now, both Bill and Hillary Clinton have said they don't have anything to add to what they've put on the record already about what they knew of Jeffrey Epstein's lifestyle. But nonetheless, they had been invited to appear in front of this committee, had refused to do so. And there was going to be a vote in the House later this week, which would potentially have held them in contempt of Congress. So just before that vote was held, they have, via their lawyers, indicated that they are now prepared to appear in front of the committee and give evidence about what, if anything, they know.
And I suppose one of the questions then is how many other people are going to have to, and what the pressure is on those who are not in the United States to do so. So obviously former Prince Andrew, but also Lord Mandelson.
Yeah, so the committee have strongly indicated in the past that they would very much like to speak to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Well, they say if he hasn't done anything wrong, and of course we know he has strenuously denied any wrongdoing, they say that nonetheless, he clearly spent time in Jeffrey Epstein's properties, around some of his other friends. There must be things that he could tell them about what he saw. And there's likely to be similar pressure on Peter Mandelson. Some members of the committee have said already that they do intend to invite him to come and give evidence. The issue is they cannot compel somebody who is not a US citizen. So they can't issue a subpoena or in any other way try to force somebody who is a British citizen to come and give evidence. So it will be entirely voluntary from Peter Mandelson or Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. And of course, the former prince has refused in the past to do so.
Meanwhile, after this latest drop of documents and material, you would have expected, I suppose, in the past that the victims of Jeffrey Epstein would be pleased. But actually, because of the way it was done, at least in part, they're not, are they?
Some of them are absolutely furious. Up to 15 women say that details were given that identify them. And details included health records and banking details, even quite a lot of nude photographs of some young women that were all released as part of this tranche of documents. Now, as their lawyers have been getting in touch with the Department of Justice, some of these details have been redacted and taken down. But now, actually, a group of lawyers are saying they want the entire set of Epstein files, the 3.5 million documents that were published at the end of last week, to be taken down until the redactions can be done properly. Because what these women wanted, they had agitated for the Epstein files to be published because they hoped they contained information that would lead to the prosecutions of some other men who had been involved in raping and sexually abusing them. Instead, what's happened is almost no information about any sexual crimes has been published whilst, as I say, these women are furious that they can be identified from some of the information that has been made public.
And meanwhile, there's this odd fact, isn't there, that this seems to have had a bigger impact, if you like, on the British establishment than it has on the US establishment.
Yeah, look at the repercussions there are for figures in public life like former Prince Andrew and Peter Mandelson, whose public lives have been completely dismantled, essentially, by what's been revealed of their relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. Now, there are some people for whom similar things have happened in the United States. Larry Summers, for instance, former Treasury Secretary, senior academic at Harvard, basically retreated from public life after a number of emails and exchanges between him and Jeffrey Epstein have been made public, and it was clear that he had a close relationship with him. That's true of a couple of other financiers as well, but not to the extent that it is of the two British men who've been caught up in the web of this.
Sarah Smith in Washington, thank you.
It's 11 minutes to nine. Elon Musk is stitching together his empire, his rockets, his robots, his artificial intelligence into what could become the world's biggest private company if this happens. It would be worth over $1 trillion. SpaceX taking over XAI, which is his startup AI company. So is it a bold new vision of tech, or is it something that is purely Elon Musk in its design? The technology journalist and author James Ball joins us. Morning, James.
Good morning.
Are these things that naturally go together? Does it make sense to squash things like rockets and AI together into one single company?
Well, there's Elon Musk's answer and there's independent observers' answer, okay. And they're not necessarily the same. Mm. Elon would say that this is all about the technology. He says that AI needs big data centers, that needs a lot of energy. And his argument is that there's free, abundant energy in space from the sun. Most other people would tell you that it's a lot harder to do anything in space than on Earth. You know, there's a reason that we're not all up there all the time. There's radiation, there's orbit, and, you know, try sending an engineer to a data center in space. It's not that easy. So it doesn't make a lot of sense on paper. And so there's a lot of suspicion this has got more to do with money than any magical technology vision.
I see. I mean, you know, we talk about these data centres and the fact that, as you said there, they are very draining on our natural resources and we do need more and more of them. You can sort of see where he's coming from. But then presumably we need them, as you were saying, in handy reach just to get the information back, even if it's only that.
Well, if we've got a data centre to, say, watch a streaming service, it's got to be quite near us. That reduces the lag. That makes it work. If it's researching AI, it could be anywhere. But you will get much cheaper energy and cheaper installation putting it near, say, a hydroelectric dam or where there's lots of gas than in space, where it's very hard to get anything anywhere. And the big issue with space is there's lots of radiation and that plays havoc with high-end computers. So a space data center would last maybe a few months, whereas the same technology on Earth would last 5 years, a decade.
I see. So it potentially, you know, it's almost sort of shoehorned in. You say, well, look, if we have these in space, but look, I also have a company that can take them to space and that can bring them back from space. And it feels like that's quite a big part of this.
Exactly that. Elon has said that Tesla's future is in robotics. Robotics needs advanced AI. It might make sense to merge his AI company with Tesla, but Tesla's already public, and so he couldn't do a big IPO and raise a lot of money. Putting it in SpaceX means that he can try and raise a lot more cash for his businesses that are burning through a lot of it.
Yeah.
And so it looks like a financial story, really.
A final thought. A big thought, James. Are we thinking creatively enough? The argument you make for this perhaps not being quite the right answer is a compelling one. But do we need to be thinking more out of the box when it comes to the way that we're developing tech?
I think we're doing some big things with technology. AI could be really transformative. I think we don't need to necessarily make it the full sci-fi vision at the same time. You know, we're doing some quite big steps trying to build robots. Why we have to sort of suddenly add space and make it even more complicated, I'm not sure, other than it sounds cool. And with Elon, sounding cool seems to be about half the journey, doesn't it?
It does. James, it's good to talk to you. Thank you. James Ball, technology journalist and author. It's 7 minutes to 9. Coming up just after 9, by the way, Ransom Man here on BBC Radio 4. You can hear it on BBC Sounds as well, actually. It's about the shocking case that shook Finland in 2020. Every patient of a Finnish psychotherapy service had their notes stolen and held to ransom online. Everything about them, everything they'd said and discussed. And so Jenny Kleeman has been hearing the victims' stories and going through that really dramatic hunt to track down the people who are responsible for the biggest cybercrime in Finnish history. It continues this morning at 9 here on Radio 4.
Now let us turn to infrared images that have revealed that an artist who painted Anne Boleyn deviated from an approved design for portraits of the Tudor Queen. And what does this tell us about the wider issue of what we can glean from the way in which people were painted many, many years ago? Bender Grosvenor is on the line, the art historian who's discovered a number of important lost artworks by old masters, and Dr. Mary Wellesley as well, manuscript historian and author of Hidden Hands, The Lives of Manuscripts and Their Makers. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Bender Grosvenor, first of all, what are we saying about the Anne Boleyn portrait? It's interesting, isn't it? What was the approved version and how do we know that there was a difference?
Oh, this is a fascinating painting at Hever Castle. It's the earliest type of that. When we think of Anne Boleyn, we probably have that image of her in her mind, which is wearing black. She's got a big B on her necklace. And this is the earliest type of that portrait, probably painted in the 1580s. And she's got hands in the picture. She's holding a little rose. So far, so normal. But the new research has found that when the artist first came to make this, they originally drew just the body. So the hands were not there. And the theory is that by putting the hands in at a later stage, somebody said, I want you to show Anne Boleyn with all her fingers, five fingers intact on each hand, because, as you know, the legend was that she supposedly had six fingers, and this was the mark of some evil sorceressness, and she was a witch. So the idea is that the infrared underdrawing shows us that someone was trying to overcome that myth.
And Mary Wellesley, that kind of attention to the way in which people were portrayed and that portrayal changed over time is much more possible now, isn't it? I mentioned that this was done through infrared technology, but we are just much more able to do it now than we would have been 10 years, 20 years, 100 years ago.
Absolutely. These new technologies are opening up manuscripts in an incredible way. So multispectral imaging is allowing us to see pieces of text, so-called palimpsests, which are like sort of ghosts of erased texts underneath visible text. But it's also part of a wider story. We're learning more about the circumstances in which manuscripts were produced. My favorite example is a female skeleton that was excavated in a monastery complex in Dalheim in Germany. And the skeleton dates from the 11th to 12th century. And in the teeth of this skeleton, there is this inexplicable blue material. And the researchers couldn't work out what this was. And then they subjected it to chemical analysis. And they discovered that this blue material had traces of lapis lazuli, which was a very, very high value pigment, which in the Middle Ages was imported from Afghanistan, created this really beautiful color, ultramarine, often used for painting the robes of the Virgin Mary. And what we think happened was this woman was a manuscript artist, and in sucking her paintbrush to bring it to a tiny little point to create fine and delicate details on manuscripts, she got traces of the pigment in her mouth, and it became embedded in her plaque, in her dental calculus, and remained there, this kind of enigmatic blue trace, for another 900 years. And what's so important about that is we have lots of visual and textual evidence of women being involved in the production of manuscripts as scribes and as artists. But this is this incontrovertible physical, chemical evidence of the way they were involved in the production of manuscripts.
It brings things to life, doesn't it, Benda Grosvenor? I suppose, I mean, in bringing things to life, do we need to be slightly cautious about how much we ascribe to the various things that we may begin to find now?
Oh, we have to be so careful because there's so much we don't know. You're quite right, Justin. I mean, if one wanted to be cheeky about the discovery of the Hever Castle portrait, you could point to the fact that the bottom of the panel actually crops off Anne's hand. And we know the legend is that she had her sixth finger. The medical term for this is postaxial polydactyl, by the way. Hmm. We know that she had that on her right hand. So you could say that the sixth finger was always there, but someone has chopped the bottom of the panel off to try and make her look less like a witch. And she does look quite sort of somber and, I don't know, witch-like perhaps in that black dress and the dark hair still. But I think the point is these portraits were produced so often not as likenesses as we might consider them today, just to see what someone looked like, but they were so freighted with political meaning at the time. They always had a purpose, a bigger picture for us to try and, a message for us to try and grasp.
And that's what brings it all alive, isn't it, Mary Wellesley? Because it's not only, as you say, the very personal stuff. You've got an image of a woman sucking the brush in order to make it very fine and all the rest of it. But there is a sort of wider political, social things as well that we are going to discover the more we can drill down, as it were, into these paintings and artifacts.
Absolutely. Obviously, it's very exciting to see images of Anne Boleyn, this elite woman about whom a lot of, you know, British school children learn about her. But one of the things that I find very exciting is when you put erasures, these hidden bits of text under a UV light, and we suddenly see something. Sometimes what you come across is an inscription written by a person who perhaps is otherwise unattested in the historical record. So this little fragment of a person writing